This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. Michael Morea. I am in Lubbock, Texas. Mr. Morea is in Palm Harbor, Florida. It is the 25th of January, 2001 at approximately 5 minutes after 9 Lubbock time. Mr. Morea, why don't you go ahead and discuss what happened when you left Duquoise?
Okay. Let's see. I think, as I said last time, but just for continuity, I was at Duquoise just getting my feet on the ground, and got a phone call from the 19th TASS one evening saying that I was to report very quickly to southern sector of the 25th Arvin Division's area of responsibility, which would have been Long An Province, and the airfield there, for reasons I don't know, was called Tan An, really just a wide spot in a highway about 1,000 feet long with a very small PAP ramp and some sandbags and some 55-gallon drums that we used to refuel our normally two airplanes that we kept there. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself. So with that introduction, at some point in time, I did, in fact, pack up. I don't remember how I traveled. My recollection is I flew down. Oh, no, I do recollect. Pete Bernstein, who was the other FAC down there, flew up and got me. That's right, a very short flight. Flew up, picked me up, and took me back to Long An. And to go back again just for a moment, I think I mentioned, but the reason I went there is the other FAC who was there with Pete had been very severely wounded and evacuated back to the States, and I don't think ever returned to Vietnam, although he did survive. So my job was to go down and be the other FAC with Peter. And that's what I did. And again, in the case of Duquoise, I anticipated at that point that this would be my home away from home for the remainder of my tour in Vietnam. It didn't turn out that way, which will come later. So about Long An, what kind of a place was it? It was certainly a nicer place than Duquoise had been. In that, although we flew from the little airfield just outside town on the road, we lived in town in what I would call rather comfortable circumstances. Try and describe it for you. We lived in a two-story, and I have a photograph of it, a two-story villa, certainly a large home, much better than normal Vietnamese standards, no question about that. We called it a villa, and that's where we lived. When I say we, I mean the entire advisory detachment that was there. For some reason, I have better memories of the Army people there than I do of the folks at Duquoise. I guess maybe I was recovering from the shock of entering combat. I don't know what it was. But I do have better memories of the people and the situation. The villa was a two-story building, as I said, fronted, I think facing north, wouldn't bet my last dollar on that, but fronted on the town soccer field. Across the soccer field, you know, some 50 yards away, were some shops, as I recall. Toward the left end of the soccer field was a road that I think went over a bridge. A little river ran through town, I think the Long An River, and took us, among other places, to the airfield, short drive. Mm-hmm. At the right end of the soccer field, looking out from the building again, was the province chief's, we called it the palace, and it was certainly an upscale thing for Vietnam. It was a very large villa on a good-sized piece of land with a walled and iron railing fence around it, as I recall. Looked like a small embassy in some foreign country. It looked like what the U.S. embassy might be in some moderately small country. Quite a nice place. So that was the geography of our situation. The logistics of our situation there was sort of like this. The advisory detachment was commanded by an Army colonel. And again, as in the case of Long An, we were nominally, I won't say under his command because that would be certainly inaccurate, but under his direction, let's say. We were there to support the Vietnamese through him. I think that's the fairest way to put it. He didn't give orders, and we didn't say no when he asked us to do something, and it was a good working relationship, and that's the way it usually works best in my mind. And that's how it worked out. When I say him, I think there were actually two colonels. I think there was one just leaving when I got there. I remember nothing more than a short, wiry, thin sort of a man, followed by a very large, blustery sort of a man, kind of on the Schwarzkopf model. Both full colonels, Army guys. Both good people, no problem. My roommate was an Army captain, I think he was. He may have been a first lieutenant. I think he was a very junior captain. Black kid, again, kind of thin and wiry. Don't remember what his specialty was in terms of why he was there, what his advisory role was. But we roomed together up in a window, in a room on the second floor of the villa. Quite comfortable, beds, dressers, mirrors, bathroom down the hall. Very nice place. And we got along great. I do not remember his name. The only thing sticks in my mind is that he had the same name as a basketball player, black basketball player, who was famous at the time, I think a college player at NYU, which, is interesting but meaningless, I guess, because I just don't remember his name.
Okay. What time period were you at Long Island again?
We're talking now, let's see, probably mid-March of 66 would be about right. I got there early February, mid-March, maybe 1st of April. I honestly don't remember exactly when I made the move.
When did you leave?
We're going to be leaving about mid-May.
Okay.
So I was only there about a month and a half, now, again.
Were there any significant operational differences between what you did at Long Island and what you did at Duquoise?
No, nothing that I can recall. It was essentially the same mission, visual reconnaissance, mm-hmm. Keeping the head of the Viet Cong down. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of differences now that I think about it. We probably had fewer ground operations now that I think about it, and we did more air attack of opportune targets. That would be point one. Point two, I think it's fair to say that the VC controlled most of the province. Mm-hmm. But probably the most significant point is it was not, as in the case of Duquoise, Hoa Nia province, Long An province was not a free fire zone. Mm-hmm. It was agricultural, at least in good part. Mm-hmm. Had been banged up and bombed and shot at for so long that it was pretty well beat up. But there was still ordinary folks in large numbers out there farming, trying to make a living off the land and trying to, avoid the Viet Cong and us both, I guess would be the fairest way to put it, and just get on with their lives, which wasn't easy.
So you had to be more careful?
Yes. I had to be more careful on your target selection. The intelligence was more important. We did spend some time up at the province chief's villa going over not so much plans as strategies, I guess. What do we bomb? What don't we bomb? Where are the good guys living? Where are the bad guys living? So that we didn't make those kinds of mistakes. Mm-hmm. There were differences. Again, much more populated. As I said, the town, I sort of glossed over that, but the town was a thriving little Vietnamese town, a market town, I guess if you were British, you would call it. Mm-hmm. We got along pretty well with the local folks, didn't have a lot of contact with them, but we'd go out and play soccer on the field and we'd shop for little things downtown and that sort of thing. So it was a fairly secure town as towns went, but again, out in the countryside, things got different. Once you left the confines of the immediate secure areas.
Were there many young men in this town?
A good question. I was going to come to that. Actually, the town was what was known as a Chu Hoi Center. It was a place where when the Viet Cong accepted the amnesty offers, usually in the form of leaflets, and we dropped a lot of those in the area too, mm-hmm. If they came in with a Chu Hoi leaflet, it meant they were defecting back to their country and out of the VC, and there was a center there for rehabilitation and trying to give them job opportunities and what. So there were a lot of Chu Hois running around town, mm-hmm. Driving pedicabs, which was the little bicycle taxi cab kind of a thing, and doing other functions in town. So there were more young men in that town, I suppose, than in most, because it was a Chu Hoi center. Mm-hmm. Let's see, other things of interest.
Well,
Go ahead.
Did the American personnel, you and other Americans that lived and engaged in activities with the Vietnamese civilian mm-hmm. population? Did everybody get along fairly well?
Oh, yeah. Those you contacted or connected with, you got along fine with. And those you wouldn't have gotten along fine with, you never contacted. You know, it was kind of that sort of thing.
I didn't know if there were perhaps any kind of concerns
town.
Concerns, especially if you get a population of young men, Vietnamese young men, are they going to want a bunch of Americans hitting on their women?
That wasn't a problem. We didn't very little hitting on the women. Tell you the truth, to my knowledge, none. I'm sure it went on, but no. Now that later in Saigon, it's a different story. When I get to the airborne division part of the story, but not in that town. No, I don't know that anybody ever said lay off the women, but we did. It just didn't happen.
Okay.
Had a few young girls in the house. Of course, we had to run a household, and we did. It was a cooperative mess kind of a thing, very informal, but we'd all chip in a certain amount every month, and somebody would run up to Saigon once or twice a month and hit the commissary and bring back what we needed, and we just had a sort of a communal kitchen dining thing, and a couple of fairly young Vietnamese girls who I remember one of them, as a matter of fact, Co Le, Miss, which just means Miss Lei, L-E-I, I think, who was one of the girls who worked for us and worked in the house, but she was hands-off. I mean, she was a very nice young girl, and if anybody had tried anything with her, he'd have gotten beaten up, by the rest of the guys, so it wasn't a problem. That certainly wasn't a problem, no, we never had that problem.
And how about prostitutes?
Not in that town. Okay. Well, I'm sure, again, they must have been in one or two, but not in that town, no. Didn't happen. Again, Saigon, whole different story, but we can come to that.
You mentioned leaflets. Did you guys ever get issued ammunition or magazine bags, waterproof magazine bags that had Chu Hoi messages on them that you could then discard after you changed out your magazines?
No. Okay. That doesn't ring any bells at all.
Okay, just curious.
Yeah, I can tell you a funny story if I haven't told it. It's in my memoirs, I think. But
what story? No, about, go ahead and tell it.
About dropping leaflets. I was flying up and down the canals one day.
Mm-hmm.
Dropping leaflets, and I was very low in altitude, maybe 400 feet if I had to guess. So you can tell right away, I guess I never followed the 1,500-foot rule, but it seems that way anyway. Dropping leaflets, I had a box of them in my lap or somewhere, or in the back seat, and reaching back and grabbing hands full of them. In any case, I had both windows open, and I'm flying up and down the canals and throwing these leaflets out by the handful.
Mm-hmm.
With the thing I didn't realize, another one of those things you learn from experience, is it was a light rain, very light, misty rain, wasn't bothering me.
Mm-hmm.
But as I was, time went by, maybe 45 minutes, I started to feel like the airplane wasn't flying right. It was flying very sluggishly, and controls weren't responding correctly, and I thought, what the hell's going on here? I mean, this airplane's so simple, what could be wrong?
Mm-hmm.
The typical looking around in the cockpit, looking for something wrong and looking left and right. Finally, I looked back over my shoulder, and what I'd done is a lot of the leaflets were sticking to my tail surfaces, and I was, in a sense, creating a big ball of paper mache on my, particularly on my elevator surfaces.
Oops.
And so I was losing control of, up and down, pitch.
Yeah.
And very slowly, I was just very, very slowly basically encasing my controls in this wet paper. So fortunately, I didn't get to the critical stage. I just stopped throwing leaflets and went home and cleaned the airplane up. But, yeah, I think that one's in my written memoir. Maybe it isn't.
I don't think we talked about that
yet. Yeah. No, we haven't talked about it, but it may or may not be in the written document. But it's another one of those crazy true stories.
Yeah. Now, when something like that happened, did you guys write up some kind of a lessons learned after action report circulated so
nothing
the
that
other
formal.
Guys wouldn't make that same mistake?
No, unfortunately, nothing that formal. We might get on the radio. We talked at night on the radio net amongst the various sites not in the entire 19th task. That was too big. But let's say maybe the western side of the 19th task. Adjacent areas would talk to each other at night. Our radio operators would usually do the talking and would just chit-chat, and we'd tell them if there was something we wanted passed or if there was some information we were looking for, and they'd try and get it for us.
Mm-hmm.
So you might say, hey, guys, I made a big mistake today. You might keep this in mind when next time you try it.
Yeah.
But again, in 66, a year later, I'm sure the answer would have been different. But this early phase, 66 and just into 67, the thing was just getting going. It wasn't formal. You know, the fac school wasn't up and running, although it was about to be the in-country fac school. So it just wasn't that formal. We didn't have the procedures.
And you were still flying the O-1 here?
Yeah, still flying the O-1. I never flew anything else. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Different models, E's and F's and G's,
right.
But they're very minor differences to those. It's just how the propeller works, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, in terms of other differences between Long On and Big Quad, does anything else come to mind?
There's one thing that comes to mind that I guess I should mention for historical purposes. And again, it's in my memoirs later when I talk about being with the Airborne Division and going up to the First Corps area, because there was a semi-revolution in progress up there with the Buddhists and the Corps commander and whatnot. But there was always a nagging suspicion, I would say, in the back of our minds when we got a target from the Vietnamese, particularly, about whether this was really military or was it political, or was it even... well, sort of political, meaning coercive.
Mm.
To be specific, if you got a target that didn't look right, it was perhaps, and we bombed villages all the time. We tried to, by that I mean villages that were collections of buildings, usually with some trees around them. That was the typical configuration, surrounded by open fields. We would bomb villages. We made a considerable effort to determine that they were empty, and what we, at least the intent was, is we were destroying infrastructure. We were destroying places where the VC did live on occasion, had lived, had fortified.
Mm.
But at least in my case, and I think in most cases, if I saw what looked like ordinary people walking around, and you could tell, you know, children certainly, even women, and probably they were VC, but in any case, if you saw that kind of people just moving around in what looked like routine habit patterns for a small village, we wouldn't I wouldn't bomb it, and I don't think most people would have. The ones that we did bomb were empty, lots of obvious entrenchments and gun emplacements inside the village and under the trees and that. And those are the kinds of things that we did attack pretty regularly.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, of course, in the process of doing that, we were decimating the countryside and driving the loyal ordinary people there were out there completely crazy, I'm sure. But that had been going on since forever.
Mm-hmm.
But back to the point. The point is that every once in a while, you'd get a target that was from the Vietnamese, and you'd fly over it, and it just didn't look right. You know, it looked too populated, it looked too prosperous, it didn't have the, there was like almost like a sinister atmosphere that after a while you got to feel about a place when it looked like it should be a target.
Mm.
And these places wouldn't have that look, and you'd have to wonder about it. You know, did they not pay their dues to the province chief that year, and he was retaliating.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something that was always, I think, in the back of our mind, something we were very sensitive to.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where, I'll tell you one story, and I don't think this is in my memoirs, it might be, the written ones again. In this province, in Long An province, I was out one day visual reconnaissance, and I spotted a flight of, I think, four Vietnamese A-1s up and down. Most of these villages were long and thin. They were built along a road or a track or a canal or something, and they were just, the four of them, up and down this one village, bombing the hell out of it. And number one, there was not supposed to be any bombing going on in the province unless me or Pete was there, the Vietnamese or no, although it was their country. I guess they could do whatever they wanted, but theoretically, we were supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I knew the village, and it wasn't supposed to be a target. So I got on the radio real quick, as it took me 2 or 3 minutes to fly over there, but got on the radio and called control back at Long An and told them what was going on and asked them to find out what the hell was happening up at the direct air support center at Benoit, which theoretically controlled all the air, and who these guys were and how they got this target and how come there was no fact.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, because I just didn't feel right, I just basically dove down to the village and flew up and down the village at very low altitude, kind of figure eights, so that basically they couldn't drop any more bombs because I was in the way and they could see me. Mm-hmm. And they went away, and that was the end of that. But when I got back, we got some wishy-washy answer that never really satisfied us, and we were suspicious that this was one of those political retaliation things that I think did occur in Vietnam.
What kind of aircraft was this?
They were Vietnamese A-1s.
A-1s?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just bombing this village?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sad story, but true. It's the way it works, especially in that kind of a war.
Were those aircraft clearly marked enough to tell that they were Vietnamese Air Force and not American Air Force?
The U.S. Air Force did not fly A-1s. At least not to my knowledge. The only time you would see a U.S. Air Force guy in an A-1 is sometimes there would be, well, not sometimes, there were U.S. Air Force advisors to the Vietnamese A-1 units, and they would sometimes fly as one of the flight of four. And sometimes you'd know that because if there was some verbal confusion between you and the flight leader, who was always Vietnamese, every once in a while an American voice would come out of the flight and say, you know, this is Gold 3. I understand what you want. Hang on a second, we'll get it sorted out. You know, we didn't normally have the language problem, and that didn't happen often, but every once in a while the guy would just chime in to let you know there was an American in the flight, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
But later in the war they did. Maybe not in 66.
Not news to me. Could well be. Yeah, I didn't know that. A-1 squadrons.
Yeah. We interviewed a guy just a few days ago that was an A-1 pilot.
Not to my knowledge.
He was
really?
70, 71.
Okay.
But I'm curious because, you know, even though those aircraft were probably flown by Vietnamese pilots,
right,
Vietnamese Air Force pilots, could someone from the ground looking up tell?
Oh, yeah. The ground, I see where you're headed.
Are they going to know that this is their own
people? I think so, yes. Yes,
are they
I think
think,
so.
Why are the Americans bombing them?
No, I think they knew. That would have been my guess. Yeah, they had been... I mean, this war had been going on for a long time, I think the local Vietnamese knew what kind of airplanes the local Vietnamese flew, yes,
okay.
and which were the American ones.
Okay.
Yeah, I would bet that. Mm-hmm. And probably, if my guess was right, you know, that was exactly the message that was supposed to be sent to us, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, sadly. But I could be wrong.
Either one would be effective, because then the province chief would be able to say, this is what I can bring down to bear.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Whether it's Americans flying those missions or Vietnamese flying those missions.
That's true. And he had that power. As I think I mentioned earlier, these province chiefs... the whole system over there was basically, at least in my mind, the entire political system was Chinese medieval. You know, an emperor who was the president in Saigon and four major warlords who controlled provinces, and then little sub-warlords who had districts and whatnot. So, you know.
Warlord system.
Or cores is what I meant. Four cores and then
cores,
the sub-districts, provinces and beyond.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so you know, not surprising. That's the way they've. That's the politics over there. Always has been, and in many ways still is.
Now, when you were flying your missions out of Long An, what was the aircraft support you would receive to bomb those, whether they be suspected enemy villages or
basically the same
infrastructure?
Yeah, basically the same as at Duc Hoa. A lot of Vietnamese A-1s, a lot of U.S. F-100s because they were at Benoit, which was close. A lot of Navy coming off Dixie Station, A-4s primarily. Those would have been the three primary airplanes, I think, that I would have expected to see down there.
And what did you bring in, preferably, to take out a suspected enemy village?
Napalm to burn down the trees and the buildings, white phosphorus bombs, 110-pound white phosphorus bombs, which the A-1 used primarily, but they could carry a ton of them, as I recall, 24 of them, and a very effective bomb, small, 110 pounds, but for, you know, just the old World War II scene of the white phosphorus trails, you know, looks like a flower. Mm-hmm. Very effective weapon. And ordinary 500-pound bombs, those would have been the three. And then guns, always, 20-millimeter guns.
In those operations, did you ever come under fire from the ground?
Occasionally, not often. It was not like up north or later, after Tet 68. It was they did not have heavy weapons. If when I came under fire, it was always small arms, you know, AK-47, nothing bigger than that.
And you mentioned villages. How about other infrastructure like bridges or things like that?
They again, they would try to build bridges over toward Cambodia, and we would again, we'd be more careful. The whole thing was more careful. If you saw a bridge, could have easily been a farmer, because we're talking, you know, a couple of twigs and a couple of planks when we talk a bridge. It could have been a farmer just trying to create a way across a canal between one field and another, and so we didn't attack willy-nilly like we did up in Haunia province, because we didn't have the same authority, number one, and we didn't have the same situation. So you had to be a little more careful. You'd go back and say, here's what I saw, and somebody would say, well, no, let's don't do that, because, you know, the situation in that part of the province is okay, and it's probably the farmers.
Right.
So you wouldn't just automatically attack, which was what we almost basically did in Haunia. That question prompted another thought. Yeah, what we did more often, Pete and I would, we used to do what we used to call dawn patrol. We'd get up very early in the morning and crank the engines just before daybreak and get airborne just as the sky was getting light. And we'd fly up and down the province. We'd pick a section of the province every day, and we'd fly up and down very low, I'm talking 50, 60 feet, over little towns and villages. And our purpose was twofold. Number one, we were trying to send a message for whatever psychological effect it was worth that we were there, okay? And so about the time the Vietnamese are getting up to start their day's work, we'd come zipping over their houses at 50 or 60 feet, a couple of towns or three or four towns every morning, different ones. The other thing was you could see a lot that way. You could really get at that altitude early in the morning when ordinary people in Vietnam are out doing their ordinary thing. You could get a sense, again, of is this village a functional, ordinary village, or is there something strange going on here? Yeah. And you could get that very quickly just by going down the street and seeing what was happening. You know, were the kids out running around? Are people carrying produce around? Or does it look very quiet? And do you spot maybe a new line of trenches off on the backside of the village somewhere? Yeah. So we did a lot of that, trying to get a feel for what really was going on, because we had to know that more than we did in the previous place, in order to, you know, to discriminate between what you did and didn't do.
What was Pete's last name again?
Bernstein.
Bernstein. Now
Bernstein. As I said, I think he was a very quiet guy, but very effective. I think he came from a very wealthy Jewish family up in Shaker Heights, Illinois, if I'm not mistaken, and I have not been able to contact him. I wish I could. I've made some efforts, but he seems to have disappeared.
Now, how many villages would you were in your area of
operations? Oh, my God. Oh,
geez, can you guess?
Hundreds, yeah.
So you wouldn't be able to do this over the same village very often.
Well, you could, in an hour's flight, you could catch, you might catch 20 or 30 of them. I mean, I'm talking really little tiny places.
So you, over the course of a week, you might be able to get a full spread?
A couple of weeks,
get full coverage, go back again.
Right.
When you would conduct these, what did you call them again, dawn, right?
Dawn patrol.
Dawn patrols?
Yeah.
When you conducted your dawn patrols, what was the typical response of the people on the ground?
You could see them.
They
would look up. Yeah. They didn't seem to be frightened. They didn't run away.
Okay, they didn't scramble?
No, not normally. If they did, I mean, they were smart enough. If they were bad guys and they scrambled, that would be a signal. So
yeah.
They didn't. They just sort of looked up, kind of a curiosity thing. You didn't get any shaking fists or anything either. It was just sort of But, you know, we still had our purpose in doing it.
Right. And I was curious, you mentioned one of the big differences between Long An and Dukwa is the more strictly enforced rules of engagement and restrictions.
Well, yeah.
And the fact that you couldn't just, it wasn't like Haunia, which is
essentially a complete free fire zone.
Here in Long An, you've got a significant civilian population
right.
that needs to be taken into account.
Right.
And one of the, of course, so I'm sure you've heard the comments and the arguments that one of the problems about fighting the Vietnam War was the restrictive rules of engagement.
But it
seems that with your experience in Long An, those were necessary.
I would not have called them restrictive.
Okay.
No. I necessary, sensible, whatever word you choose. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you really thought that you were going to win this war someday, which back then we did, mm-hmm. then the whole concept of converting the people to the government side was viable. Mm-hmm. And if you were going to try to do that, obviously, beating them up unnecessarily was not going to achieve that objective. So I think we took it seriously.
So yeah. it did not frustrate you?
No.
Or your fellow pilots?
I don't think so. We selected targets based on what we thought were real, and those mm-hmm. we attacked and the others we didn't. And so I don't think there was frustration, no.
Okay. And I was, in the same regard, I was curious what you thought about, if you even thought about, the internal inconsistency between your experience and the necessity, as you appropriately stated, of having restrictions on your activities in a particular province, with this with the overall strategy employed by the American commanders, that of attrition, killing our way to victory.
Okay, I understand the question. I'm just not. And your preface was probably accurate. I don't think. Again, in 1966, I don't think we thought much about that. Everything was kind of new.
Yeah.
I think we still believed that we were going to that the effort was to win mm-hmm. and that we could.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of that probably changed about 1968 with Tet and new administrations and what's his name got in?
Abrams?
I'm talking on the political side. The
Nixon?
Johnson's Secretary of Defense.
McNamara.
There you go. Yeah, those.
We'll isolate them.
Those days, I think that's when, because I was home by then,
mm-hmm.
and those were the days when I think everybody started to get the sudden realization that our real intent here is to minimize casualties and get the hell out of here as quickly as we can.
Mm-hmm.
So, which took years, but still, I think at that point that it was obvious that was our intention.
Right. Well, in your area of operations and mm-hmm. in Long An itself. Did you know, that the standard tactic employed by U.S. ground forces was the search and destroy, the sweep and clear, or whatever they want to call it?
Didn't have any U.S. ground forces there, so again, it wasn't relevant. The
mm-hmm.
the locals did some of that, although I think, and I don't know why, there was less of it there than there was in Haunia, and I think. Maybe the reason was the higher population density and the higher difficulty of actually defining where the enemy was.
In Long An.
In Long An, right.
Dupa, which was a free fire zone.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I think there was more, surgical is not the right word because it wasn't that good, but
yeah.
but it was more surgical, let's say, than Haunia was in that we did look for specific targets. They had more artillery down there. The Vietnamese did 105 howitzers, and they used that occasionally to fire on targets. There was one other thing that's of interest that I ran into down there, and that was the Phoenix program. You're familiar with that?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. That was I won't call it a center, but maybe it was. There was a Phoenix outfit there. Very interesting operation. They lived nearby in town, but apart from us. And I give you a thumbnail description of what I remember of it. It was commanded, as I recall, by a very a slim, trim, taller than average Vietnamese captain.
Mm-hmm.
Story was that his family was politically out at the time. Whoever was running Saigon at the time, his family had been with the previous government, so I think Diem, perhaps. I think his family was connected with Diem,
mm-hmm.
who, of course, was assassinated, and Tu, I think, was in at the time, although I could be completely wrong on that. And so if that's correct, then this kid was kind of a Diem family,
mm-hmm.
and out of power and out of favor in Saigon. So as a result, he had to go find something else to do. And I guess they told him, why don't you go be a Phoenix unit commander? So he was. His troops were, it was a small unit. If I had to guess, I'd say he had maybe 30 people. I could be wrong. The story is that he did a lot of his recruiting at the Saigon prison. And basically would go down there, and I actually went with him once. And he would just talk to the prison keepers and say, have you got any likely candidates, you know, young, tough men in here? And he'd talk to them and make them an offer, you know. How'd you like to be out of here in 5 minutes? And I'd give you a uniform and a gun and 3 square meals a day and a place to sleep. But here's the other side of the coin. And he would just yank them right out of the jail and take them back to Long An and train them. And they were pretty good. They were very loyal, as best we all understood, to him and to the program, and they did their job. The only other thing I remember, I did go out on one patrol with them one night, and you know what their mission was. It was euphemistically called counter-terror, but what it was is we were supposed to assassinate the VC leaders before they assassinated the few remaining friendly village leaders. That was, I guess, the essence of it. Went out on a patrol with him one night and didn't make any contact. We were looking for some guy, but we never found him. And that was that. The only thing I remember is I was carrying a Swedish K submachine gun with a silencer on it, and I'd never carried one before. And the thing that stuck in my mind was that how heavy the silencer was. It must have weighed 5 pounds, just the silencer. It's not like in the movies. And the only other thing I remember is that there was an American advisor with them who was not military. A big, again, as I recall, big, bluff, Irish cop-looking guy, and I think that's what he was. I think he was a retired policeman from Chicago or some such thing, and he was their advisor. He did live in the advisory detachment villa with us, but the Vietnamese captain did not. And again, this is all best as I recall it. Right. It may be 80% accurate, who knows.
And the other side of the coin, as you put it, was their mission, which was Viet Cong infrastructure neutralization.
Right.
Either capture or kill.
Yeah. That's what I understood, yeah. I've never read any of the books about it, but that was my understanding at the time, yeah.
Did you ever witness them actually bringing back prisoners?
No.
Okay.
Never. I don't think prisoners was the objective normally, although it may have been at certain times, yeah. But in any case, no.
Right. And when was the first time you actually heard this referred to as Phoenix?
There. It was the only experience I had with it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other Americans rotate into that unit while you were there?
The Army guys were in and out. And again, I just have vague recollections of people. Pete and I did our thing all day. We were preoccupied is almost the right word with, you know, the airplanes and the maintenance and the fuel coming in and what our mission was and timing and backing each other up and that sort of thing and getting 3 square meals and some sleep in between. The Army guys, you know, at night we'd have dinner and chit-chat and have a beer or two, but never got close. I don't have any recollection of any close relationship with any of them at all. They kind of were preoccupied with what they did, and we sort of came and went in the building, and not a lot of deep socializing.
And how did the villagers seem to get along with that Phoenix unit?
No contact that I was aware of, or if there was, never made that connection. Did they know it was there, and what did they think about it? Never made that linkage.
Okay. How did you handle maintenance for your aircraft?
Maintenance was very simple. We had a crew chief, I think, who lived there with us, and it was his job to go out, and it may have been two, to tell you the truth, I don't know. And the radio operators, same thing, a couple. And their job was to go out either with us or just a little bit ahead of us and prep the airplane, make sure it was fueled, give it a pre-flight, which wasn't very complicated, stand by to untie the airplane or pull the chocks for us if necessary, pump fuel, very routine, very limited maintenance. was possible if you had a brake that was low on hydraulic fluid and therefore, you know, a little mushy or whatnot, they could unscrew a cap and pump some more hydraulic fluid in there and put the cap back on. But on the other side of the coin, the airplane was very, very simple, so there wasn't much that it needed. They could do basic stuff. Mainly they were there just to pre-flight and kind of support us with very basic mechanical and ground service kinds of things, although we could do it by ourselves for that matter, too. You pull the chocks and start the engine, hold the brakes, and taxi off all by yourself, untie it and fuel it and whatever.
Right.
Really, the maintenance system in a nutshell was that the airplane was to be rotated back to Benoit every 100 hours. For serious maintenance.
Yes.
And the airplanes, as best I understand, got a pretty thorough going over there. Then you'd get a fresh one, and, you know, as you approached 100 hours, you'd call them up, and they'd tell you, come on, bring it on up, and we'll give you another one. Or sometimes they'd give you another one. Usually you had to wait for it. I think I mentioned that, because we had, quote, our own airplanes. Mm-hmm. And if you had to wait for it, usually it was an overnight stop at Benoit. Different when I was in the airborne division, again, because of Gene McCutcheon's connections and just his personality. Well, we never waited. When we got there, we dropped one, picked up another one, and left. But that's later. I think, not to rush us along, because I'm not doing that at all, but I think you're going to find that for whatever reason, just the rapidity of the way things were happening and changing so fast to me that I don't remember a lot about these first two assignments when it comes to DP. You would think I would remember some of the Army guys and whatnot, but I just flat don't.
No, I completely understand.
Yeah.
It's a long time ago.
Yeah, well, it's not the time so much. I don't think I would have remembered it 6 months later.
Okay.
You know?
Like you said, you were very busy.
Yeah, and moving fast. Yeah. The Airborne Division thing, I was there longer and more settled, and I do remember names and faces there. Okay. But anyway.
Well, let me just a couple more questions about your time in Long Island. Back to your village operations.
Mm.
When you would bring in airstrikes or artillery or whatever into one of those villages, any secondary explosions?
Rarely. I don't think they had that level of munitions at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think what you were really dealing with was small units organized on the village level,
mm-hmm.
and probably armed with individual weapons, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a few. They had a fairly effective Russian shoulder-fired rocket, kind of a bazooka kind of a thing that the VC had significant numbers of. They may have had a few of those laying around, but even that's a very light weapon. They may have had a mortar or two, but nothing in the way of stockpiled munitions at any level at all. No, you were basically just trying to keep them disorganized, and if they were setting up something that looked like a military camp or a defensive position, you tried to ruin it for them. That was really about that simple.
Okay.
Yeah.
So no significant caches were worked from this result.
Nope.
And how about the presence of vehicles? Anything?
In the towns, that was about it. In the towns, you.
How about the villages you bombed, though?
No. I was going to say rarely. In fact, to my knowledge, never. And by vehicle, I mean even something like a cyclo, nothing.
Okay.
No, that's an interesting question. I never thought about that, but no, I don't think I ever saw a vehicle. You would see the vehicles of any description, and even those were primitive, only in the larger government-controlled towns.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
what they used outside was strictly the water buffalo hitched to a primitive but effective plow. That was it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And while you were at Long Island, did you ever receive any feedback after a bombing run where the Viet Cong primarily the Viet Cong, but maybe even Pavin, were trying to use that particular incident for propaganda purposes to try to turn the population against you?
Not specifically. I suppose we were generally aware that that could happen and probably did happen. But specific instances, no.
Uh-huh. What kind of briefings would you receive while you served at Long Island?
Casual. Well, be careful with that word, but they were casual. We would sit around either at the villa or up at the province chief's place and just in general go over how have things been, what have we done, how effective have we been, where ought we to be focusing our efforts. Sometimes something's fairly specific, but it was not, I guess I never thought of it this way, but it's obvious in this conversation here that it wasn't a very specific kind of a place. It was a very general, the place was fairly homogeneous as a province, and the mission was pretty much find out what's going on, try to locate those places where there really is VC activity, which was generally trying to build up infrastructure, defensive, and you know, ultimately offensive infrastructure, and destroy it without destroying the local population that wasn't involved in that. And I think it was, as it turns out, it was probably about that simple. And I never thought about it that way, but it seems to be the way it's coming out.
Did you ever get enemy confirmed enemy kills that you would send
down there? Not many. Again, it was only a month and a half.
Right.
Some, I think those that I could reasonably confirm, I probably confirmed myself rather than somebody later on.
Okay.
You know, on a rare occasion where I did see someone, and there were several, you know, two or three occasions where there was obviously caught somebody in the act, so to speak, of building a bunker or building, you know, digging a trench. And was able to confirm just visually that we had killed him, but it was rare, not often. I think more often we were bombing empty villages that were either had been or were being fortified.
Yeah.
That was probably our main target.
Yeah. And when you were doing your visual reconnaissance, how long would it then take you if you spotted suspicious activity,
yeah,
or a suspicious village?
Yeah.
How long would it take you to bring ordnance on
target? Oh, if we really hurried, you know, there was no doubt in my mind something was going on, and I made the call back through the channels, and I'm not going to describe the system to you. I know you understand that silence is acknowledgement system, which we had.
Well, why don't you explain it for?
Okay, I will.
But for readers later.
I will. I mean that was the standard classic system, but using that system, I could probably have air on station in, it depended. If there happened to be somebody nearby, maybe 20 minutes. If not, maybe 40. Mm-hmm. Inside an hour.
Okay.
I could almost always have something working inside an hour, yeah.
What would you do in the interim?
Just try and refine my impression of what it was that I was looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Just fly over it, fly around it. See if I could generate any activity, either good or bad. You know, if I could generate civilians, then I'd just call it off. If I could generate guys trying to sneak away into the bushes, then, you know, it would just intensify my impression that I had a serious target. So, that's a fair description. Just try and refine in my mind what it was I was looking at and how I was going to deal with it.
And why don't you go ahead and describe real quickly the process of getting approval to fire on a target?
If I can remember it. Yeah, well, we had... We had two systems, the pre-planned system and the immediate system. The pre-planned system basically worked this way. Boy, you're really calling on my memory now. I would make a request to attack a target at a given time I would request at least a given airplane, given ordnance for a given target at a given time. And that request would go in parallel up two chains. It would go up the Air Force chain, meaning my radio operator to the direct to the direct air support center at Benoit, to the TACC in Saigon, which controlled all the air in Vietnam, and the request would be dealt with, and I would either get an approved or a disapproved or an approved modified somehow. Maybe, you know, approved it but can't do it until this time, and you're not going to get F-100s, you're going to get something else or whatever. And I would get the word back down through the same channel that here's your approved air request. Be there at this time, and this is what's going to happen. At the same time, that request was going up through Army channels. and there was a parallel agency at every level, so that at the desk there was an Army liaison, and at the TACC there was, and of course at my working level there was. And that request would go up in parallel, the significance of that being that at every level, the Army guy could say to the Air Force guy, yes, we know what this guy, your Air Force guy down there, is requesting. Our guy knows what's going on. They understand it. They approve of it down there, and so do we. So it was a coordination thing. And it worked quite well. And it also worked on the Vietnamese side. Usually our Army guys would work the Vietnamese side for us. Well, not usually, always, Army side. So really, in a sense, it was going up three channels. Air Force channel, U.S. Army channel, advisory channel, and the third channel being the Vietnamese Army channel. And it was that simple. The immediate system worked essentially exactly the same way, except that if I made a request, I would, depending on where I was, usually I would go through my radio operator, because I was always in his range, and then he would go directly to the Direct Air Support Center at Benoit and ask for an immediate strike, which would mean either a launch of an airplane on alert or a diversion of something that was on a lower priority and that was near to me and seemed to have the right characteristics to fit the situation. The difference in the immediate system was very simply that in order to expedite it, you did not require approval at each level. The only thing you could do at each level was call a halt. So silence was considered approval. So that if my Army guy, who was the Army radio operator, who was with my Air Force radio operator, chose not to tell his boss that I was requesting an immediate airstrike, that was essentially approval at that level of my request. Or if he told his boss and his boss said, sounds good to me, he did not have to chime in officially with that. He just said nothing and it was approval. And that procedure was true all the way up. So,
to include the province chief?
Yeah, that's an interesting. Yes, to include him. I never thought about him, to tell you the truth, except that his he was the Army colonel's guy, and he didn't have the communication. So I guess the answer to that is if the Army colonel chose not to mention it to him, then the answer was yes. If the Army colonel chose to mention it to him and he said nothing, then the answer was yes. I think, to be honest, most often the Army colonel chose not to mention it to him unless he sensed something big enough. He probably took that on himself. Probably, in fact, the colonel probably wasn't involved that often. It was probably whoever the duty operations officer was, who was probably some Army captain or maybe a major.
But what about Vietnamese personnel that were probably monitoring those exchanges and activities, or were they, intentionally in the loop? That is, a Vietnamese radio operator listening in for that type of stuff, so that they
wasn't
could
there.
Inform the Vietnamese civilian hierarchy.
No, if they were, they weren't officially there. They would have been there just spying on us, which may be. They may have had people with enough command of English. Mm-hmm. Radio people listening in on our nets so that they could keep track of what we were doing. I was never aware of that. I don't think they did, particularly not at the tactical level. If they were doing that, they were probably more interested in what was going on in Washington. So that's a good question. Never thought of it. But no, I don't think they had a system like that. I mean, I've lived in other countries that I won't mention here where I know that the host government, very friendly host government, was very definitely listening. And if I had been them, so would I have been. So, but that's another story.
Okay. Anything else that you recall from your time at Long An?
If you're interested in just a couple of amusing stories.
Absolutely.
Okay. One, I can remember, I'm a very heavy sleeper. And we had a defensive plan for our villa. Which was a good idea, because you never knew if the town got overrun, we were going to have to defend ourselves. And in fact, in the front window of our bedroom, my roommate, whose name I can't remember, and I had a Browning air-cooled, which is the barrel with the holes in it, 30 caliber machine gun from God knows when. But it was mounted on a table, basically, so that it would fire out the front window of the villa. our field of fire, in other words, was the soccer field. And he was the shooter, and I was the belted ammunition flowing smoothly. He was the shooter, I guess, because he was Army and he was senior to me, although I was a better shot than he was. But anyway, so that was interesting that we were set up that way. And the rest of the building was defended in various other ways, anything from passive, you know, barbed wire and things like that to active defenses that we had located around the building, which is not the point of the story. The point of the story is one night we did come under mortar attack, the village in general, and I think us and the province chief's place in particular. And it's comical because the mortars were exploding on the roof. They're light mortars, 60 mortars or something about that size. They were literally exploding on the roof of the building, and I slept through it. My roommate literally shake me awake and get me out of bed and over to the machine gun and explain to me that, hey, we're under attack, and you know, the plan calls for you to be here, not in bed. So that was kind of amusing. But I've always been a heavy sleeper, and not much bothers me once I go to bed.
Wow. Did the village only get shelled that once while you were there?
Again, it was only a month and a half, but it was just that one time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any casualties?
No, it was over. It was a very, just one of these brief flurry things. It was over before you could think about it almost. Mm. There was no ground assault. It was just mortar.
Okay.
The other thing that was kind of amusing, in a way, is I have a degree in accounting, and I was, fairly fresh out of college back then. My roommate had, among many other additional duties, he was like the unit bookkeeper. He was supposed to keep track of the mess funds and whatnot. And I saw him one night out in the hall. There was a little hallway behind our bedroom. There was a little desk out there with a lamp on it. He was obviously pulling his hair out, trying to figure something out, and I didn't know what it was. So I said to him, I says, what's going on? What are you doing? And he was showing me these books. It was the house books, so to speak. And he said, I can't understand it. And I got to explain it to the colonel. We've run out of money. We don't have any money to go to Saigon and buy any food. And he said, I don't understand it. I've been filling out this, and he knew nothing. He was working from the Army How to Be an Accountant manual, put this number in this box, add it to this box, and that was about all he knew about accounting. But he said, I've been filling this thing out. I know it's right. I've been sending him into the colonel. He's been initialing him. Everything's okay. I don't know. All of a sudden, we're out of money. Well, the long and the short of the story, which was obvious to me, I looked at it, and it took me about 2 seconds. He had been very dutifully, at the end of each month, putting the number that was the bottom line in parentheses, which is what the book said to do under these given circumstances. If A is larger than B, subtract A from B and put the answer in parentheses. And parentheses in accounting means it's a loss. So for months, they had been actually spending more than they'd been charging each of the guys' dues, so to speak, and they had been slowly but surely operating in the red and running out of money. But it took up till this month for them to get to run so far out of money that they really didn't have any, cash reserve to run up to Saigon and actually make the next month's purchase. So I explained it to him. We had a good laugh over it. And then he said, would you go in and explain that to the colonel? Because he'll kill me if I go in. So I went in and explained to the colonel, that the captain hadn't done anything wrong. He was, it was the fact that and I didn't put it that way, that both of them were ignorant of what they were looking at.
Mm-hmm.
The captain and the colonel, they didn't understand the parentheses. And I said, you haven't been charging enough, so here's what you got to do. You got to assess everybody a few bucks to build up the pot again, and then you got to start charging a buck or so more every month to stay that way. And that was the end of that problem. But I always remember that. I always thought that was kind of amusing. Just, the bureaucratic thing of here.
Yeah.
You're the unit accountant. All you got to do is follow these rules and everything will be okay. And of course it isn't. So, but that's about it. I don't remember much else about the place. A friendly atmosphere. I remember that. The Army guys were great.
Yeah.
The food was good.
Yeah.
What
was the total American presence there?
I don't know.
Approximately? Was it up to 100?
Oh, God, no, nothing like that. I'm talking maybe 15 guys.
That's it?
Oh, yeah, it wasn't much more than that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And besides mortar attack, how about occasional sniper fire?
Nothing.
That kind of stuff?
Nothing. Nope. Town was pretty secure, as I said. It was a pleasant little town.
Yeah. And what was how about the Arvin presence?
In and out of town, the Vietnamese, I think, intentionally kept their soldiers out of their towns.
Mm-hmm.
The soldiers didn't get paid much. They were inclined to steal, you know, just petty theft. Like soldiers anywhere, they'd go have a couple of drinks and get in a fight, and nothing unusual about them. They're perfectly normal, just like anywhere else. And I think they were kept away from town, yeah. Not too far away, but away. Okay. You know, I'm 3 or 4 miles outside of town and in a garrison area. So I'm sorry.
And were there any other particularly memorable operations, that is, when villages that you bombed or operations that you engaged?
It's a very routine place, okay. in that sense. Okay. Yeah, very routine.
All right, so...
To set the stage for the next time, which is this. About a month and a half into my assignment at Long Ann, mm-hmm. I got a message, verbal or whatever, one night from my radio operator, saying that the colonel up at the 19th TAS, whose name I've forgotten, although it's on, I think, one of my OERs, a short name like Fisher or Thomas or Thompson or some such thing. The colonel had called, and he had a new job for me. I was supposed to go to Benoit post-haste, and I was going to be part of the 19th TAS infrastructure at Benoit, and I was going to be instructing Vietnamese pilots in the 01. For the duration of my tour, and I really reacted to that. It was not what I wanted to do at all. I'd been to Benoit. It was like an old cow town. It was just a dusty place, not much going on, a lot of guys, just too many people around, and it was non-combat, and although certainly things happened there, but basically it was a non-combatant place. Did not want to go there. And I made that very clear. I got on the radio and I talked to the colonel and I told him. I said, I'm not coming. To which he said, yes, you are. And I calmed down and I told him, I said, I volunteered for this. I didn't volunteer to be an instructor in some, garrison for the rest of my life. Not what I came for. And he understood. And he said, well, look, he said, somebody's got to do it. You haven't been here that long, so we can get some longevity out of you in the program. And he said, you're it. He said, unless... you can find a replacement, somebody who would rather do it, and you can have his job. I don't care, was basically what he said. So what I did is I got on the radio that night, and I called around the 19th TAS area. I don't think I went outside the TAS, and I called all the sites and basically said, here's the deal. Is there somebody that would like to go do this, and I'll come do your job. I don't care where you are. And I got a taker. I got a guy who was with the... Vietnamese Airborne Division Advisory Detachment. Here now my memory starts to get better. Detachment 192, based in Saigon, co-located with the Arvin Airborne Division, which was based in Saigon. And we'll get into those details later. But this guy, very frankly, was a captain. I think I remember his name, but if not, I'd rather not say. And he very frankly said, look, I got a wife and two kids. At home, he said, I am red marker 4. The last two red marker 4s within the last 6 months were killed. He said, I'm getting shot at all the time. I'm not having a good time. I don't want to do this. And he said, if you want to come do it and let me go be the instructor, I'd be tickled to death to do that. And I said, sounds good to me. And shortly thereafter, I talked to the colonel again. He said, fine. And so... without remembering the details of it, we made the swap. And he came to Long Ann and worked with Pete, and that was the last I saw Pete and that whole situation. And I was told by the Airborne Division Detachment to meet up with them at Tay Ninh, which was the northern, as it turned out, province of the 25th Arvin Division. In other words, Long Ann, Hau Nia, Tay Ninh, up north. They just happened to be operating out of there, the boss there, Colonel McCutcheon, said, meet me up at Tay Ninh, and we'll, bring you into the unit, basically. And so I did. I forget how I got up there. I think I went to Benoit. Yeah, that's how I did it. Gave my airplane to the guy who was going back to Long Ann, and then took an Airborne Division airplane that was there and flew it to Tain in to meet up with the airborne division guys. And so at that point, I joined my third and final unit in Vietnam, and one where I have probably more to say and more specific recollection of a lot of things, names and faces and things that happened and all of that sort of thing. Okay. But that's the at least the intro into how that all happened.
Okay.
And that's probably a good place to stop.
Okay. Just to clarify, which airborne division was this again?
This is the Vietnamese Airborne Division.
Vietnamese.
Yeah, the Arvin Airborne Division. So in a sense, and in a very accurate sense, similar in many, many ways to the U.S. 82nd Airborne.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a quick reaction, national reserve strike kind of a thing, light in terms of armor and weaponry, but very quick. And it was stationed at Tansanute for reasonably obvious reasons. That was where you could marshal a lot of airlift in a hurry if you had to and move them out to wherever they really needed to be.
Right.
So that's that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, if you'll hold on one second, I'll just end the interview officially for today. Thank you very much.
Hey.
This will end the interview on the 25th of January 2001.
Okay.
This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. Mike Maria. It is the 1st of February 2001 at approximately 9 o'clock Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Maria is in Florida. Sir, why don't we begin by discussing your time with the Arvin Airborne Division?
Okay. As we'll recall, last time I sort of set the stage for this by describing how I wound up assigned to the Arvin Airborne Division. So we can pick it up there. Again, as best I recall, I went to Benoit, probably took an airplane in there for a 100-hour inspection, dropped it, picked one up that was destined for the Arvin Airborne. We're going to use a shorthand here. The red marker fax, that was our call sign, red marker. Forward air controllers were the forward air controllers that supported the Arvin Airborne Division. It just red marker comes out quicker than the other. So I picked up an airplane, as best I recall, and flew it up to Tainin Airfield, which is where at least several of them were operating at the time. Landed the airplane and asked around, I guess, and was told that, I think those guys are having lunch. And so I made my way to a building, which was very close by, 100 yards at the most, and wandered around a little bit until I found the people I was looking for. Again, in my written memoirs, I remember the building quite distinctly. It was very, at least my recollection of it, it was very large for Vietnam, concrete, ugliest thing I'd ever seen, kind of an ugly, rusty yellow color. And I described it as looking like something left over from the Maginot Line. And in fact, although I never knew for sure, it could easily have been built by the French as some sort of a semi-fortress. It was dark inside, thick walls, very gloomy, dingy place, as you might expect somewhere in the Maginot Line would have been. In any case, I found the two people, three people I was looking for, and walked over to the table where they were eating, introduced myself, and sat down. And that's how my relationship with these folks began. I have described, again in writing, my first impression, which was almost frightening. They wore the very distinctive camouflage uniform that only the Arvin Airborne Division wore. I think, again, a leftover from the French Foreign Legion. It was not the same as what the Vietnamese Rangers or Vietnamese regulars or RFPFs or anybody else, as far as I know, ever wore. Strictly the Airborne Division wore a kind of a dull red beret, and the guys were all in the Arvin uniform, which I'll explain in a moment. Joe Granducci, a captain at the time, was one of the people I met. Joe had an enormous handlebar mustache. Fortunately, I have a photograph of him from back in those days, which displays it beautifully. Sergeant Belasco, he spelled either with an E or an A, B-E-L or B-A-L, I'm not sure. I think B-A-L, was one of our radio operators. I've always described him as looking like a Mexican bandit. He was Latino, short and squat, and he too had a mustache. So in the dark room and with the uniforms and the mustaches and whatnot, they really made an impression, as I said, of walking into a Mexican cantina in a bad B-movie or some such thing. Mm-hmm. And I, this clean-cut 26-year-old lieutenant at the time, was somewhat shocked. But it didn't last very long. They were good people, actually excellent people, and I got along very quickly with them very well. On that same day, at some point, the boss, who we all had red marker call signs. I turned out to be red marker 4. Granducci was red marker 2. But the boss, who was a lieutenant colonel at the time, a very old man for the job relative to other people who were in the job, Gene McCutcheon was in his 40s, may have been as old as 47 at the time. And Gene was just known as red marker, no number, or the marker. That was just a little pride thing with him. Gene showed up at some point during the day. He had been out on a mission, and we got introduced. I don't think I flew any missions that day or in that period. I think the whole thing wrapped up just about the time I was getting there, whatever the Arvin unit was doing, was wrapping up. And somehow, very soon, I think maybe that same day or the next morning, we made our way back to Saigon, which, as I've said, was the headquarters of the unit. Let me touch, before we go further, on the unit itself as best I can.
Okay.
I think I've said before that it was called the Arvin Airborne Division, although at the time it was nothing like division size in reality. It was probably a large brigade relative to, say, the 82nd Airborne Division, and had three full-up, maybe even robust, regiments in it. But that was really as strong as it was back in those days. And so although it was always known as a division, and all the signs and whatnot in the cantonment area at Tansanoute said division, at least in my time, it was not. We had three combat-ready regiments, as best I recall. So we can call it the brigade or the division. In fact, we used to refer to it both ways.
Okay.
It wasn't that important. We knew what we were talking about.
Yes, sir.
The unit, as I've said, was very similar in structure, training, equipment, and mission as the 82nd Airborne Division was and is today in the United States. That is to say, parachute, very light, the best of leadership, probably man for man, and the best soldiers, probably man for man, that the Vietnamese Army had. Sure, somebody would argue that with me, but that's fine. And had the mission of National Reaction Force or National Reserve, which meant that if there was a problem somewhere in the country, and it could be anywhere in the country, frequently a regiment of the division was directed to go somewhere to conduct some sort of a mission. It was also, I was led to believe in conversation with the Army folks who were the advisors there to the unit, the advisory detachment, 193, I think, 192 or 193. I think 193, I can check that. Detachment 193 had indicated to me that they were also there as kind of coup control in Saigon. They were, at least theoretically, and I think in fact, loyal to whatever the present government was in the interest of stability, and so they were there to quickly react should a coup arise, either in town or from outside town, one of the corps commanders or whatnot. So that's a thumbnail sketch. The leadership, I remember almost no names, although I have documents of awards that I got from them and orders and things that that I could probably glean some names out of. Let's see. Let me stop for a breath. There is, just by way of information for the historical purposes, a Red Hat organization.
Oh.
I can give you leads to that if that ever becomes interesting to you.
Absolutely.
This is an organization of, it's actually, I think, officially called the Association of the Vietnamese Airborne. And it is an association, it's here in the United States, of people who were either in, which means some of the Vietnamese who managed to escape here and still live here, or advisors to, namely people like myself and others, the division. It's pretty well organized, a couple of hundred members, kind of focuses around Fort Bragg, which shouldn't come as a surprise, has facilitated a couple of monuments, in fact. I think one at Fort Benning, one at Fort Bragg, and maybe one at Arlington, to the Airborne Division advisors, several of whom were killed in action in the course of the war. They have published a hardcover book, a little history of the division, which I have a copy of. It runs $50 to buy it, and there aren't many left, but I do have one just for the record. Some years down the road, somebody is looking for one. And that's about it. The advisors were also top of the line, most of them 82nd Airborne Division people. Mm-hmm. Just as a matter of curiosity, Pete Dawkins, who was a very famous football player when he was at West Point, a captain at the time, was an advisor during my tenure there. Barry McCaffrey, who is, as we speak, he's just resigned, but he was the drug czar under the Clinton administration after he retired from the Army. Mm-hmm. I think he had been the commander of Southern Command down in the Panama Canal area prior to that. General Schwarzkopf, who everybody knows General Schwarzkopf, was also an advisor in the unit during my tenure. I believe he also was a captain at the time. He may have been a major, but I think a captain.
How much interaction was there between you as a FAC and the other American advisors?
Okay, good question. Yeah, and I appreciate you leading me. I'm drifting here, and I think I drifted far enough.
No.
Yeah, it's a good question. The answer is that here's the way it worked. In Saigon, very little. We, the FACs, five of us, lived in a villa, a very nice house, two-story, what you might see in a middle-class Japanese family today, a two-story stone building, bedrooms, a living room, a kitchen, servants' quarters, a courtyard, that sort of a place. We lived at this place, the five of us, when we were in town. The Army advisors lived elsewhere in the MACVEE compound in their own setup. So we did not have the interaction socially or time off like we did at Long An and at Tukwa. At work, when we went out to the division area to do one thing or another. On Tansanute, which was probably a 20-minute drive from the house through town. We did our thing, they did theirs, casual contact here and there. Our only serious contact was when we went in the field. And when we went to the field, they and we, in other words, the Army advisors and the FACs, would get our heads together with the Vietnamese commander, usually a regiment and maybe his operations officer and his company commanders. We would get together somewhere at an airfield, and sit around a table, get our heads together, and plan operations or coordinate operations. They did the planning. I wasn't directly involved in the planning unless I saw something that I thought didn't look right. But then to coordinate what their plan was with me so that I could provide the most effective air support in terms of time and objectives and potential danger spots and that sort of thing, ordnance, all those kinds of things, plan of movement. So we would sit around the table and talk about what we were up to until we had a good grip on what the plan was. And then they would go back into the field, and I would go wherever I had set up shop and prepare to provide the support that we had planned. That interaction, it wasn't particularly exciting. It was very mundane, but it was very close interaction. Mm-hmm. In my mind at least, the closest interaction we had was when we were actually in an operation. And although we were, they were on the ground and I was in the air, that's when we talked the most. That's when, at least on occasions, the communication was most intense. For reasons of contact with the enemy or other reasons, typically the latter, and when I really did what I was supposed to be doing for them, namely provide them the kind of support they needed to effectively operate on the ground. So that is kind of a thumbnail sketch of what we did in one form or another many, many times. I would say that I and the other forward air controls, and I guess we ought to name them for the record right now. The guys, when I got there, Joe Granducci, the captain I mentioned with the handlebar mustache, was just about ready to leave. The guys who I worked with, we sort of all got there at more or less the same time, and they were still there when I left, were a major named Paul, actually Oliver P., to be technically correct, although he always went by Paul and preferred Bud. He certainly didn't like Oliver. Bud Fisher was a major fighter pilot. There was also Bill Stewart, who was a captain. There was myself. There was Wayne Kanouse, K-A-N-O-U-S-E, and the boss, McCutcheon. And when I left, all of those people were still there. So, and I never met my replacement. I guess he was coming in just a day or so. At least I don't recall. I don't think I ever met my replacement. He was coming in shortly after I left. So those are the guys I lived with, and we would rotate the duty. If a regiment went out, one of us would go with them, usually only one. So it made it both good and bad for us, and I can discuss that in a minute. But so we would stay at the house a couple of days off if we'd just come in from the field, do not much of anything, just take it easy. Then if we weren't scheduled to go out immediately and things got slow, we'd go out to the field and do paperwork, performance reports on the radio operators and the crew chiefs, or you know, small little things, nothing very earth-shaking, after-action reports and things like that. Then our number would come up, and we'd go out with a regiment, typically, wherever they were and whatever they were doing. So I would say, on average, I was probably in the field just a tad over half the month on any given month, and probably home just a tad under half a month. Say 20 days out, 10 days in would probably be about right. I have my complete Form 5, my flying record from those days, and if I had to, I guess I could sort of count flights and pretty much figure out where, at least how much effort I was putting in on any given day. It does not, unfortunately, indicate where I was. I wish it did, because I've forgotten.
Quick question.
Go.
The units that you would find yourself engaging, enemy formations, what were they principally? Viet Cong, PAVN combinations?
Depended, well, as a very general rule, in the early part of my time as a Red Marker, they were generally Viet Cong. Toward the end, we did start to make more contact with North Vietnamese units, I think largely because toward the end we started to move further north. To put it another way, my early operations, and we would have gone up and back and up and back and up and back on a rotation, were in the area from Quy Nhon north to a place called Bong Son, and generally, mostly, let's say, east of Highway 1, which was the main north-south road, sometimes operations into the mountains to the west, but not very far to the west. So that there was a sector there in Tu Cor that the division seemed to have a lot of missions assigned in, and so we spent months, I suppose, on and off individually going up there to support the units that were involved. During those operations, the units that we engaged were almost entirely Viet Cong. Later in the tour, for both military and political reasons, and again, it's in my memoir there, but the written memoir, but I can touch on it at least. We went up to First Corps, and we operated, say, generally in an area from a place called Hue Phu Bai ultimately to the DMZ, but not beyond. So in the context of those operations, let me back up. When we were at Quy Nhon, I operated, out of Quinon itself, Quinon City, which was maybe a 10-minute drive from the airfield itself, a large MACV compound, a relatively comfortable concrete building, rooms with bathrooms and all of that sort of thing, and kept my airplane at the airfield. I operated out of Phuket, which you have to be careful of in later years. In fact, while I was there, it was completed. There was an airfield called Phuket, which is a very large American airfield, just as I recall, to the west of Highway 1. The Phuket I operated out of was a little tiny RFPF compound just to the east of Highway 1 and actually within sight of the new Phuket. Very primitive place. Also operated out of a place, had so many names up north. It was called Bongsan, I think Dog Field, English Field, and it was a dirt runway that was heavily used by the 1st Cavalry Division, U.S. 1st Cav. There was a special forces camp very close, probably also called Bongsan, that had its own little runway, as I recall. And I spent some time in the special forces camp operating out of there just because it was convenient to the things I was doing on those, maybe a week that I spent with those guys. With my airplane parked inside the compound, used to taxi it through their barbed wire gate and park it, and then taxi out to the airfield just when I needed to go because of security consideration. The place was not safe.
Again, Pavin or VC?
Again, VC, best I recall.
Just out of curiosity.
During operations in that area, I know I jumped up north and then came back, but that'll work. During operations in that area, that two-core area, we did on occasion engage VC units. A lot of it, I would say, was typical of the way at least I saw the ground war. They were milling around. We were milling around. We were trying to find them. They were trying to either ambush us, create some casualties, some morale difficulties, some psychological effect, and then disappear. There were, in that area, to my recollection, what you would call a pitched battle, but even at the low level, company level, that lasted for very long. It was just an occasional contact, a quick firefight, maybe some airstrikes, and then the whole thing would just sort of disappear. And again, very typical, at least in my experience. Just as an aside, not that it's directly relative to anything, the South Korean units, which had come over during the same time frame for various political and operational reasons, also had operations within the same general area that I've just described. They had a small AOR, area of responsibility, north and west of Quinon, as best I recall. And, of course, further west toward Pleiku and into the mountains north of Pleiku was the 1st Cavalry, was more than a headquarters. It was a gigantic AOR with a lot of operating locations within it. So we, on occasion, did operate adjacent to and in coordination with both the Koreans and the 1st Cav. So let's see, where does that leave me? Again, okay, your question, I guess I answered it. Not a lot of contact. Occasionally, particularly when I was at Bongsan, and there's a story in there about, it's kind of in my written thing, again, sad story, of which there are many, about killing a friendly soldier who was stealing fuel. That was at Bongsan, a local, so much to say that it's hard sometimes not to go forward on six fronts at once here. That was a local regimental headquarters for that province, similar to, say, what Duqua would have been. I was there simply because it had an airfield, and it was there was a U.S. advisor or two there, and some semblance, well, I won't say some semblance, good security, a place to sleep. So that was the reason I was there. Why did I bring that up? Help me, Steve. Where am I here?
Well,
I I'm talking about the kinds of operations we ran into. Again, at those kinds of locations, we did on occasion come under probing attack, particularly at night. You almost never even knew the size of the probing force. They were typically small. They were always repelled rather easily. Trip flares would go off in the middle of the night. We might see a small number of enemy on the perimeter. Some shots would be exchanged, and the thing would go away. So I guess that's a big, long answer to the question of, you know, what the level of intensity was, but I guess in the process I also covered some other things.
Yes, sir.
Useful.
Real quick, how close to the Cambodian border would you get when you operated in two corps?
Not close at all, because we were over on the western side of the corps, Highway 1 running pretty much up the eastern side, east coast, in the coastal plain prior to where the mountains really began to rise toward Cambodia or Laos. So not close at all, no. When I was at Duqua, of course, we would fly right up to the Cambodian border. Yeah.
But when you mentioned that when you operated out of your base there in Saigon,
yeah,
the further north you'd go from there, the more contact with potential paths.
Yeah.
So I was curious how far that was from the border in terms of infiltration of the North Vietnamese into South Vietnam.
We did not operate much in the highlands. At all. So, and I think there were probably several reasons for that. Number one, an airborne unit wandering around in the jungle probably wasn't going to get much accomplished. The population was highly concentrated in the coastal plain. I think the effort was at least to attempt to control both that territory and that population. Again, we're talking 66, so the political thinking was still kind of upbeat at this time. You know, hearts and minds and all of that sort of thing. We were going to win this thing. And so that's where they concentrated their effort. Now, when we did go north, and again, it's in the written memoir, but my recollection is the first time and the first reason we went north was because there were two things, and history books may prove me wrong, but this is the way I understood it at the time. There were two things going on in the First Corps area that were not good. Number one, the Buddhist leadership was creating a lot of political turmoil. An uprising, I guess, may have been just short of an uprising, but Buddhist monks were burning themselves to death in town squares. There was a lot of agitation within the Buddhist church against the government. And so I think the first reason we were sent up there was to kind of put a lid on that. My recollection is that the unit that went up that time was just a little bit bigger than one regiment. It may have been two, although I was the only FAC, so maybe I'm wrong there. Maybe it was just a regiment. I remember. It was just a regiment, but there were other Vietnamese units that went up as well, Rangers and what have you. But we went first away Phu Bai, kind of a staging base, got our act together there a little bit. I ultimately, and again, there's a story in my written memoir, went in a convoy from Phu Bai to Way City, medieval city with the moat around it and the old battlements that really looked like something out of the Crusades. And I operated out of a small airfield that was inside the citadel, actually inside the city. Okay. And then the troops ultimately moved to a position somewhat north and, as I recall, mostly a little bit west of town. And the other factor beside the Buddhists is there was some intimation that the First Corps commander was trying to set up his own little country up there or break away from the Saigon regime or reinstall somebody that he was more favorable to in Saigon. I don't remember the details, but there certainly was this suspicion that we needed to get more national troops into the Corps than he could muster on his own and put a lid on that as well. So probably a dual mission, and as best I recall, it succeeded. Certainly things didn't get worse, and in fact they got better, or quieter at least.
How much time did you spend in Quaifu Bai and Hue?
You know, it's one of those things I don't really remember, Steve. A couple of cycles, a couple of rotations perhaps, 20, 30 days total,
okay.
Best guess. I sure wish I'd have written all that down, but did I think I told you. I did. I tried to send letters to my mother mm-hmm. with little hints buried in them that I could use later, and again, very untypical of my mom. She at some point got rid of them, so those are gone. And she never threw anything away, but those went for some crazy reason. So I've lost that chronology I wish I had.
Well, you mentioned in the written memoir that you sent to me
yeah.
that there must be two, because you mentioned in this written,
yeah.
Shorter version, a larger, I guess, written version with pictures and stuff.
See, no.
No?
No. The one I sent you, it should be, what, about 10, 12, 15 pages?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
That is it. That's,
oh, okay.
That's the memoir.
Okay.
Now, I have at home here, of course, a box full of other things, including
right.
photographs and pieces of paper, award citations, firearms that I carried while I was there, and
okay.
I've got a lot of things I've collected. But no, the one you have is it.
Good enough. I just brought it up because you mentioned in this written version
yeah.
that when you first arrived there
yeah.
to Saigon to work with the Airborne Division,
right.
that this was most of the work, a lot of the work, especially, I guess, for the first months,
yeah.
was in the context or within the backdrop of a civil war in South Vietnam against the Viet Cong, and then as you spent more time there, slowly increasing amounts of, I guess, northern support cabin and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I was curious if that was your perception at the time, or is that retrospective?
That's retrospective. I don't think I cared at the time. And it has to do, really, with what happened after Wei and Wei Fu Bai, because, obviously, the closer to the north you got, we were up in the Da Nang area. The air activity out of Da Nang was very intense, both in support of us and in support of other things that were going on up there. There was the Marine Corps had a very large presence, and we were at least generally aware of the kinds of things they were doing, and they were deeper in the mountains, and the kinds of intensity of action that they were finding. Time had ticked by, and I think that we were learning that there was a lot more infiltration coming in from Laos through the mountains, the western mountains of extreme northern South Vietnam, mm-hmm. to be accurate about it, than we had to contend with down in the south. So yeah, there was at least a vague, probably more than vague, recognition that we're closer to North Vietnamese units.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, although probably not accurate, but the only time I actually remember engaging an obvious North Vietnamese unit was toward the end, when we finally moved out of the Wei context and moved further north to Dong Ha.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Dong Ha was just a lovely place. It was just solid mud most of the time. Was a functional runway, and it was a U.S. Marine base for all practical purposes, a staging area, a holding area, a jumping-off point, an operational area. So typically when you got to Dong Ha, it had more the look of a real forward operational military base that maybe a guy like me would remember from Korean War or World War II films than anything else that I had seen, which was either small but tranquil or very large and, you know, semi-stateside. Am I making sense there?
Yes, sir.
You know what I'm saying? Like, if you went to Phuket or Quy Nhon, except you knew you were in Vietnam, you could have been in Arizona in terms of the danger level or the level of facilities, you know, which were decent at least. Phuket, old Phuket, the little place I mentioned, was tiny and primitive, but rarely seemed to come under any serious attack, probably because there wasn't enough there to attack. But when you got to Dong Ha, you got that different feeling. Maybe it was just because the Marines were there. But there was a lot of vehicle traffic all the time. I say it was there mud and rain, and maybe the airfield was busy. As I indicated again in the written memoir, we did come under serious attack there regularly, not a few 60 mortars, but 120-millimeter rockets and lots of them.
Why don't you go ahead and discuss the events of October?
Okay, what is October? You
October
help me.
October 15th, this was when you were flying the patrol and basically happened upon at North
Vietnam. Oh, okay, yeah, and that's, I guess, what I was leading to. Right,
yes,
yeah, you're right, October 15th. My regiment, let's say, was operating north of Dong Ha, and there wasn't a lot of room between Dong Ha and the DMZ. You know, a map would indicate how much it was, but I don't think it was 20 miles. And they were operating in that area, doing, you know, search missions, trying to just control that territory. And I was flying cover over them. I don't even think I had any air in my pocket, so to speak. Nothing pre-planned, nothing in a holding pattern anywhere. They were maneuvering, and I was flying cover over them. And if my verbal story doesn't quite check with the written one, we're going to have to just, you know, if we care to, reconcile the details. But
okay.
Verbally, basically, they simply made contact very suddenly, very abruptly, as I recall, with a North Vietnamese unit of my recollection about equal size, fresh out of North Vietnam and just across the border. This thing all occurred within a couple of hundred yards of the border of the DMZ, as best I remember. The terrain is relevant. It was what I would call almost like West Texas scrub, not forest or jungle, certainly, nor was it the farmland, which was more typical of the coastal plain. It was probably coastal plain, but uncultivated because of its proximity to the DMZ. And my point being that the visibility was pretty decent from the air, although not necessarily very good from the ground. If you can imagine hunting deer in West Texas, you don't see very far in that scrub oak, but I could see very well down into it. So they made contact, and a firefight began, and they were, I'll come back to this point, but they were taking some fire. I don't recall any casualties on the American side, at least not immediately, but they were taking fire, and there was a lot of initial confusion, as there always is, as to where the fire was coming from, you know, where the main thrust of the enemy force was. I was able to see that very readily and to see them maneuvering. Of course, by this time, I've got an airstrike on the way. I know that Ken Carnes was my radio operator at the time back at Dong Ha, and close enough to where he could hear my FM radio transmissions, which we've never really touched on, but that from ground to air or air to ground, we were usually communicating on the FM band because that's what the Army uses for close-in coordination when they're on the ground. He was close enough to hear my FM transmissions, and as soon as contact was made, he, and rightly so, didn't even bother to wait for me. He called the Direct Air Support Center at Da Nang and said, start getting some air up here. And, you know, a few minutes later, I called him, and he said, don't worry, it's on the way. And I said, okay, or something to that effect, and went back to watching what was going on the ground. And let's see, so the first order of business, and again, it's in the written memoir, was to try to get the guys on the ground to understand what the disposition of the enemy force was. I think it's in there. I used a very simple technique, which I had never used before. I thought it up on the spot, but it worked like great. I could see one of the Army advisors on the ground. I mean, I could tell who he was. I just told him simply lay down on the ground, and I made him squirm around on the ground until his feet were pointing at the main thrust of the enemy. And I think he had a map on his face, and, you know, just so I could see which end of him was which, but it wasn't that hard anyway. But I think I told him, put the map over your face and squiggle around until I tell you to stop. And I said, okay, your feet are now pointing at the enemy. And so they were able, because of that, to concentrate the force and the fire in that area, and they really did stop the NVA long enough for me, for the air to get there. There is one funny story I do remember. Sardonically funny, perhaps, but I don't think this one's in the memoir. I do recall throwing a red smoke grenade out of the airplane, again, trying to mark the enemy position, and it went into a foxhole. Foxhole, I guess, is the correct term. It was like a grave, almost, in its dimensions, probably about 6 feet long and a couple of feet wide and not quite as deep, maybe 3 or 4 feet deep. Pre-cut, had been there for a while by the NVA or the VC, but there were a couple of NVA in it, and I threw the red grenade, and it actually went in the foxhole where they were. Now, this thing, if you've never seen one, it doesn't look like much from a distance, but it is sputtering smoke and fire pretty vigorously. And so they bailed out of the hole and were immediately shot by the guys on the ground.
Yeah.
I don't think that one's in the memoir, but it's a true story. Mm-hmm. I was getting, by that time, because I'm near the end of my tour, or at least well into it, getting pretty good with smoke grenades. And as you can tell, both from this narrative and from, you know, ultimately when I got the, whatever they, the, I guess the, what did I get for that? The DFC and the, from the Air Force side and the Air Medal with V from the Army guys through Army channels, because the Air Force doesn't do an Air Medal with V, but the Army does, and so they put me in for that. But that narrative suggests correctly that, you know, when I got shot up a little bit there, that I had wandered rather low in the course of this thing, you know, stupidly, but I did. Had gotten down to, I don't know, maybe 500 feet, maybe four, I don't know. I was really into the fight, but I wasn't watching myself, and so I was able to toss a smoke grenade with pretty good accuracy from that altitude. So the long and the short of that story, of course, is that they were under some considerable fire and in some danger. It was getting late in the day. We'd been there a while. I was running out of gas. And the best of my recollection, I did not put in an airstrike. A local FAC, whose name I had not known until the FAC reunion this recent past up at Hurlburt, I met the guy just by casual conversation. We were talking, and it turns out that without a doubt, this is the guy who actually, a local FAC, who actually relieved me as I was running out of gas and put in most of the airstrikes. In fact, I think all of them, to settle the area down while I flew back to Dong Ha and got my airplane repaired because it had been shot up a little bit. Actually, mostly just checked it to make sure it was still flyable. And then came back to relieve him as darkness was setting in. I think the NVA had pulled out by then, although we never really knew. And most of what I did on my second leg, on my second flight back in that area, was to set up defensive positions for them, find some likely-looking spots where they could put people, and make sure that there was a flare ship on station for the night, a C-47 Spooky, and then put them to bed, and then went back to Dong Ha. And the next day, you know, back to normal. We never made a contact like that again. I do remember certain things about that particular thing very vividly, because it's probably the closest I ever came to getting killed by the enemy. I probably came closer doing stupid things by myself in the airplane, but as far as enemy action is concerned, it's probably the closest I came. I do recall vividly one NVA soldier stepping out from behind a bush, wearing khaki shorts, flip-flops, a straw hat with a silver finish on it, I think painted silver finish on it, probably to reflect the heat, a khaki shirt and an AK-47, and he opened up on me at reasonably close range for an AK, as they may be 400 yards, and hit the airplane two or three times, shattered the left rudder pedal, stripped the manufacturer's label off the generator without actually hurting the generator, put a dent in it, and one came through the window, and there was a huge amount of plexiglass. Actually, it broke both windows. Came in the left window and went out the right. So broke some plexiglass and had a lot of plexiglass and dirt and dust in the airplane, which is another story. But that was, you know, obviously vivid in my mind. Again, the only thing I remember saying is I'm hit. And before I could even explain that I meant I, the airplane, which I considered part of me, Carnes had already called. Again, rescue service was on their way, or rescue helicopter was on its way from Da Nang before I could turn it off. So he was good, like they all were. Mm-hmm. He did what he needed to do without, you know, a lot of guidance.
Well, why is the plexiglass and dirt another story?
I'll get to that because let's see. Let me finish here, and then I'll come back to that.
Okay.
To see if the other things that what else do I vividly remember about that? The guy with the machine gun, who also, by the way, was killed as soon as he stepped out and fired at me. Somebody got him.
Okay.
So I guess point is this was fairly close. You know, I mean, this was very everything was very visible. Not just a bunch of little dots running around on the ground. These were real people on both sides, and very obviously so. If there was something else I was trying to say, I've forgotten it. Thing about the plexiglass is, when the bullet came up, and I don't know that this is in my memoir either, but when the bullet came up through the floor and broke the rudder, because you know there's just a lot of dirt and debris on the floor, just not a ton, but enough. And the plexiglass flying around. Later that night, I kept seeing something wrong with my left eye, and I presumed that I had just maybe a piece of dirt or a piece of glass or something in my eye. And it was of some concern to me, so that when I get back to Saigon, I went to see the flight surgeon. I said, "There's something wrong with my left eye," and he, you know, good examination at the hospital there, which was probably the best one in country. Well, that and Da Nang, I think. And I couldn't find the optometrist, couldn't find anything. I said, "Okay, you know, that's fine. If you can't see anything, I'm happy." And he said, "No," he said, "I'm not happy. If you're seeing something, there's something wrong." They sent me downtown Saigon, this is very interesting, to a female Vietnamese optometrist. Now, you got to understand that, you know, we had this, sadly, in almost every case, this, they're, you know, a third world country kind of an attitude about the locals, and being sent to a Vietnamese eye doctor wasn't my idea of a great idea. Now, what the hell is this guy going to do to me? Turned out to be a woman, educated in Paris, you know, very, very good optometrist. She couldn't find anything either. So I said, "Fine, great, we'll call it a day." But the system now was in full swing, and it wouldn't stop. I actually got air-evac'd, if you can imagine, out of Vietnam to the U.S. hospital at Yokota in Japan for a week while they looked at me there. And it was misery because, you know, I was at Yokota. I'd been there many, many times as an airlifter. It's a pretty good place to relax and have a few beers and something good to eat in total peace and comfort. They wouldn't let me out of the hospital, although I was ambulatory, and the only problem I had was this maybe eye thing. Well, long and the short of it is it was finally diagnosed as something called a vitreous floater, which everybody has. They're just little things inside your eye, like the little hard white part of an egg white that you get when you're separating an egg. There are things like that floating around in the liquid part of your eye, and they sometimes obscure your vision or whatnot. You don't see them unless you look up at a clear sky or swim underwater with your eyes open normally. And it had always been there, is the long and the short of it. It's just that I'd never noticed it until this trauma of getting shot at and hit. So that's the point of the story about the debris flying around the cockpit.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, who was the other FAC?
I think the other FAC, I have his name somewhere. If it's not in the memoir, if it's not in the version I sent you, it is in my absolutely most recently updated version.
Okay.
It won't take time now, but I'll look at it and I'll get it for you next time. His call sign and his name are in there.
Dan Riley.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah, so it is in there. Good. Yeah, I thought I sent you the very last update that I did. So, yeah, and he told the story, I mean, absolutely perfect. He knew every detail.
Wow.
So I hadn't a clue who he was until the reunion, yeah.
Okay. Now, a couple of clarifying questions.
Mm.
Back to Tukor real quick. When you were down there near the Bongsan Plain and that area, did you ever fly into or hear about a place called Two Bits?
Two bits, no.
Okay.
Means nothing
good,
to me.
Good enough. Also, quickly back to the Civil War issue.
Yeah.
Even though a lot of what you've talked about today and what you've written in your memoir seems to be retrospective.
Right.
When you were there.
Yeah.
What was your impression in terms of who you were really fighting? I mean, were you really fighting against North Vietnam, or did you feel you were fighting against an internal threat, helping the South Vietnamese?
Oh, we knew when we went to I Corps, to First Corps that time, the Wei Fu Bai Wei thing. We knew we were fighting two enemies at that point.
Two enemies.
Oh, no question.
And that was
maybe three. The VC Viet Cong as one in one lump, the North Vietnamese. Forces of whatever size and style, and the Buddhists and the corps commander. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. No, we knew it. It was all very subtle, though. I think the commander of the airborne division unit that went there was probably a little more senior than he had to be. They probably grabbed at least a full colonel, maybe the most senior full colonel. And these guys all knew each other. They'd been fighting in Vietnam for endless years. So this guy was no stranger to the First Corps commander, nor vice versa.
Right.
And I think when he went up there, you know, there were meetings, and it was all very cordial and lots of smiling and bowing and all of that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But everybody knew what was going on. You know,
That's
not unusual. You know, you can find that in corporate America. You know, everybody's having a drink and dinner and smiling and being charming, and they hate each other.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least they're trying to cut each other's throat in a business sense.
Right. Now, did you have an opportunity to talk about these types of things amongst other facts, or amongst the, or with the Army advisors that you worked with?
Not those kinds of things. We when we had a chance to talk, my conversation with the Army advisors was generally strictly operational, and that's the only time, as I said earlier today, that's the only time I ever really saw them.
Okay.
Once in a blue moon, the division would have a party. Just some sort of a party. It's in Saigon, you know, and they did bring in some local girls of a better quality than the normal, and you know, they would be there to dance with, and that's all, and just, you know, female companion, somebody to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversation during one of those evenings might drift a little bit away from operations, but they were rare. At home in the villa. On Yen Do Street there in Saigon, I forget the number. I have it written down somewhere. Number 3 or number 34, Yen Do was the name of the was the address of the villa.
Mm-hmm.
What did we talk about? We tried. I almost think now unconsciously. It's a good question. I never thought about it. Unconsciously, we didn't talk much about operations unless something really worth sharing came up. The operational discussion was when we passed the baton. If I was leaving, say, Dong Ha to go back to Saigon for my break, and you know, Wayne or Bill was coming up, I'd certainly give them a very good operational baton pass, you know, of the terrain and the threats and what we'd done in the past and what would look like in the future and where you could get good support from the Marines and, you know, maybe what the DASC was doing well and maybe where they weren't doing so well. A good operational pass of the baton, but once we got back to Saigon, it was like trivial, almost just casual conversation about this and that, and that was about it. You know, it's funny because we spent like a full day. I think we slept a lot, to tell you the truth. I think we probably got up late in the morning, maybe 10 o'clock. You remember, it's hot as blazes all the time, no air conditioning. We did have fans and whatnot. So you got up late. You didn't move very fast. Might have had a light lunch, you know, read a book, take a nap, read some mail, write some letters, a little conversation in the afternoon, have an early dinner, you know, go to your room, read some more, get to bed. It was pretty mundane.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversations were very general and usually more about home and the future, you know, what's your next assignment and that kind of thing than operational.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Were you able to develop strong relationships with your fellow FACs, friendships?
Strong,
or was that
funny
was
word.
Was it avoided?
No, it was not avoided. The opportunity was limited to get a very close relationship, and since we rarely actually worked together, Like, for example, I read Charlie Pocock's book, Viper 7, and Charlie's situation was closer to what I had at Duqua and Long An, but never long enough to get involved. His relationship with the one or two other facts that were co-located was obviously much stronger. Mm-hmm. You came home every night, same guys, same Army guys, and you had a whole year there. With us, we rarely functioned operationally together, and so just a friendly, more than casual, friendly relationship, I guess, is as far as I would go with it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Another question about Arvin.
Yeah.
What was your assessment of the Arvin units you supported down in Saigon and then in, up in I Corps?
Well, the Arvin Airborne Division was excellent in every respect. You couldn't, at least within reasonable limits, fault them on anything as far as I was concerned. Mm-hmm. Their leadership was hand-picked from the best of the Vietnamese military leadership, had been in the division. It wasn't like the U.S. Army or the U.S. Air Force where you got a new assignment every 3 years. These guys had been with the division since forever, the senior people, and the young guys, I think, anticipated staying and growing in the division. The troops were good, as any troops will be. If they're properly led, they'll do their job. The American advisors were, I won't say a cut above, that wouldn't be fair. I mean, the American advisors who came to go to the Ranger units or even just the ordinary Vietnamese units were probably very good. But I can tell you that the guys who came to the Airborne Division were, from personal experience. I mean, guys like Schwarzkopf, and I think I mentioned Colonel Labrosi, who had a battlefield commission in Korea. Strangely, for just reasons of rotation, I think I seemed to find myself in the field with him more than most of the others. I'm a kid and he's an old man. It was another one of those father-son relationships, almost like I had with Gene McCutcheon. I mean, Gene was 20 years older than I was, for crying out loud. So, and Labrosi, with a battlefield commission from Korea, was probably right up there too. So those are the people I remember best. But the unit was, if you went to the unit area, the division area there at Tansanute, it was well maintained. It was kept clean. It was good. I certainly never found fault with them. This is the thing I was going to touch on and drifted away from. We drifted back. There is, and we may have already discussed it, but it's a fact. There is, you know, it's just a matter of history that because of the strength of U.S. air power and the effectiveness of U.S. air power generally in the South and the availability of it, and the fact that these guys have been fighting since long before we thought about getting over there, there was a tendency, I think, in all cases, when contact was made, to hold rather than attack and just hold position, sort of pin the enemy until the air could come in and destroy them. And frankly, if I had been a Vietnamese division platoon leader or company commander, and I knew that was the situation, I can't imagine why I'd go charging in with rifles. I'd be dead today, theoretically or perhaps, whereas I know I can get the enemy destroyed probably better than I can do, and I'll be there to do it again tomorrow. So there was very definitely, at least in my opinion, that tendency, and I think that tendency also applied in the division. If the story up, you know, where I got my DFC is classic. You know, I told them where the fire was. They held the enemy, didn't retreat, certainly, but they're not going to, you know, do a cavalry charge like in the movies. Hold the enemy until the air comes in and destroys them. So, you know, that's probably a point significant. I know you've been probing with a lot of your questions through the course of these interviews, so you obviously have, you know, some thoughts in mind that you're trying to fill in some blanks. And I know, at least in my experience, I haven't been very helpful in most of them. But this one I think is significant.
Yeah. With my question about Arvin, my interest is not so much in clarifying or verifying anything in particular, but you know, there's already assessments out there.
Right. Exactly my point.
Yeah. They're not very glowing or very positive.
Yeah.
So based on, I want to know what you think, because Based on what you had said already, I thought that it seemed like the airborne division and the units that you were fighting with were pretty good.
Oh yeah, no, there's no question.
They were doing a great job.
And I'll be honest with you, what little I knew of the U.S. units, particularly the 1st Cav, because we worked adjacent to them very often, was that they were as inclined to do that as anybody else, and for all the same good reasons. If you've got a company of NVA out in front of you and you know exactly where they are, you got to be semi-suicidal to go charging into them when you know you can have napalm and 500 bombs all over the place in 10 minutes. Makes no sense to me. I mean, there is an element of human survival even in the craziest soldier, I think, or maybe not in the craziest. But I think, you know, and again, it's a question of leadership. I'm sure there were U.S. units with some Sergeant Marvin in front of the, you know, as a company commander who did things that were very brave and probably unnecessarily, unnecessarily brave at times. But again, generally, I would say that's the way the war was fought. Find the enemy, pin them, locate them, and let the air destroy them, at least whenever possible. Yeah. And I think, why not?
Yes, sir. You mentioned in your memoir another interesting incident.
Yeah.
A personal attack against you when you were driving through a city.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was when we went up to Wei. Mm-hmm. When we went to Fubai, and then, as I said, we sort of got our act together there, I think is a phrase I used. And then we convoyed up Highway 1 from Fubai to the Wei Citadel, and then beyond. We mean, now meaning the entire package, the ground units, myself, my radio operator. My crew chief wasn't with us. I don't know how he got there or the airplane got there, now that I think about it, because I didn't fly it in. Don't remember that part. But the airplane ultimately got to Wei. I did not fly it into Wei. I may have flown it into Fubai. Or, you know what we did? I remember now. We literally stole it from the local facts, in the sense that McCutcheon got the TACC down in Saigon to order them to turn loose one of their airplanes for us. That's right, because it was too far to go too quick to get our own up there. So I think they probably positioned it for us.
Okay.
And I think my crew chief probably flew in at a Caribou or some such thing, and then my radio operator and I went with the Mark 108 Jeep to Fubai, and then we convoyed.
Okay.
The thing was that I had to get into the Citadel, which is where my airplane, and I guess by then my crew chief was, and where I was going to, we were going to, again, camp out and bunk out. I wound up, now that I think about it, bunking out with an Australian captain who was the advisor to a local MPC, APC, Armored Personnel Carrier unit. I have no idea what his name was, but, you know, typical Australian. He had a bunk, and so that's where I wound up sleeping. But I'm drifting. The story was that, yes, we had planned, using the maps, that at a certain point, as this convoy was heading north to a position northwest of Wei, that I was going to have to break out of the convoy alone and go to the Citadel. Now, I've described in the memoir that best I remember, practically speaking, all the way from Wei Fubai to Wei City, which is a considerable distance, the road was lined with local people stirred up by the Buddhists the thing I most vividly remember is that they had their little home altars or shrines, which every home has, no matter how small. It's just a table 2 foot and a half by 2.5 or so, but a little altar with symbols which don't mean anything to me, not understanding Buddhism, but incense burners and pictures and little statues and whatnot, and it has to do, I know enough to know that it has to do with ancestors and whatnot, but these were all moved out of the homes and lined the roads, and then people standing there as well, watching us go by, obviously making a statement. I don't remember any really belligerent or hostile looks, but sort of making a statement's the best I can do. You know, we'd just as soon you weren't here, and we want to let you know that we're not going to get hostile. And they didn't. The thing, again, in the memoir, I remember, it has to do with the Buddhist colors, gold and red, very predominant banners and things like that, or at least that sticks in my head, a lot of gold and red cloth, tapestries and altar covers and little flags and whatnot lining the route. And there were lots and lots of people, and the long and the short of it is that at the appointed point adjacent to Way Citadel, I and my driver, who I've chosen not to name, broke out of the convoy, just very quickly made a right turn out of the convoy down a street, almost a boulevard, actually. I could see it. It looked a little like Paris in Way, making it for the military portion of the Citadel. And that sort of break in the pattern agitated a lot of the bystanders, and we wound up being chased by a mob of a couple hundred people, probably. And the again, amusing part now is that my radio operator, who was not one of the brighter ones, reaches for his revolver, which we all carried, and almost before I can stop him, he's leaning out the left side of the Jeep trying to drive it, and playing stagecoach shotgun kind of guy with his revolver. He didn't fire it, and I just quickly told him to put it away, drive, and don't miss a gear, because they're going to eat us if we miss a gear. And so we did. Very quickly, this whole thing took seconds probably before we finally outdistanced the mob and got to the Citadel. But it's very vivid, because I really figured that although the crowd had been peaceful, things like this changed the nature of the crowd, and just the fact that they were running and now getting in a physical mode, if they had caught us, I think we'd have been in serious trouble, because we were absolutely alone at that point. So,
was this the time when someone hurled a grenade at you?
No, that was different. That was in Saigon.
That was in Saigon.
Going from the house at Yen Do to Tansanut, just, a perfectly routine morning, just jumped into, we had a couple of Jeeps. And drivers, I guess they should be, the FAC had a driver, his name was Fung, just a young enlisted man out of the division, and his duty assignment was the FAC's driver. Mm-hmm. I have photographs of him, and McCutcheon had his own. Fung served the five of us, and four of us, and Gene had his own driver named Lung, L-U-O-N-G, I think, L-U-O-N-G, and I also have a photograph of him, but... So Fung, I guess, had picked me up. I think it was just the two of us at the house to take me out to the base to do something. As I said, OERs or after action reports or something. Mm-hmm. Just because I was bored and wanted to go out there. And we were driving down one of the main thoroughfares that led from the house to the main gate at Tansanut. My picture in my mind is an intersection, fairly broad, again, almost Parisian kind of a boulevard, lots and lots of people around, cyclos and people on foot and bicycles all over the place, and a hand grenade was thrown from we were heading north, if I remember right, that's the way the road went to Tansanut from the house, and a hand grenade was thrown from the left of the Jeep somewhere, I never even saw who threw it, at us, I'm sure, but it sailed over the Jeep and landed on the sidewalk to the right and exploded, and I'm sure in a little market area, which was typical, something for sale on the street kind of a place, fruit or coffee or God knows what, could have been anything. And it exploded, and we didn't blink. I mean, we just kept right on going. I wasn't about to stop and render aid or see what the heck it was all about. That was just pure survival at that point, get the hell out of here. I'm sure there were people injured, if not killed, but it was... That's the way it went. Again, one of those, over before you can think about it, and took less time than it takes to tell about it, stories. Mm-hmm. And it happened occasionally in town. It was just, attempts like that.
Would you guys report that to anybody? I mean, it seems like that would be great fodder for Americans and Vietnamese both working on counterintelligence.
I think I mentioned it when I got to the base, but it was understood that those kinds of things would happen. And, probably generated almost no interest other than,
Good enough. Okay, this will end the interview with Mr. Morea on the 1st of February 2001. This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. Mike Maria. It's the 13th of February, 2001, at approximately 5 minutes after 9, Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas. Mr. Maria is in Florida. Sir, why don't you go ahead and talk about your final impressions upon learning you were leaving Vietnam and as you were getting on the plane to get back to the United States.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I hadn't really thought about that, but I think I can, you know, sort of dredge it up from memory. I guess, again, and I've probably overused the word, but it is the thing that sticks in my mind most, I guess, about the whole experience is this aspect of surrealism that surrounded the whole experience of being in a war. And I think what happened is, past the 6 month point, you begin to realize that you really are there, you know, and you really have been doing certain things, and you really have been fighting a war, and more to the point, you actually begin to realize that, you know, I could get killed here, but I'm halfway through, and I just might survive this thing, and that sort of starts to dawn on you in an indirect, in a probably subconscious sort of a way, but it also starts to dawn on you that if that's the case, you got to start planning for the future. I think when guys go to war, it's almost like everything stops in their mind. At least it was with me, and you just sort of get on with it. Being a bachelor, maybe it was more that way. I didn't have family and kids to worry about, but it was sort of like the whole world stopped, and I'm just going to do this, and maybe I'll survive it. And then you start to get this feeling, by golly, I am going to survive this. I've got experience. I haven't done anything terribly stupid yet, and I've got less than half the time to go. So you start to think about the future, and, you know, assignments and all of that sort of thing start to come up. And I think probably, I'm jumping around here a bit, but I went on 2 R&Rs while I was in Vietnam. I think the rule was that if you were allowed 1 big one, and the married guys typically went to Hawaii or someplace and met up with their wives, and the single guys, like me, took 2 short ones, like a week each, and I think we were allowed 2 total weeks. And I went somewhere, I forget when, but I think probably in about October or thereabouts, I went to Bangkok by myself, ratted around town like a bachelor will in a place like Bangkok, and had a good time. Drank way too much and got back on the airplane and came back to work a week later. And then, pardon me, we're going to unfortunately have some of that on the tape today. But and then in December, I remember more distinctly, I took my second one, which was to Hong Kong. And by the time that second leave rolled around, you know, I was only 2 months from leaving Vietnam, thoughts of assignment and a new life, and, you know, going back to normality and civilization and all of that sort of thing were definitely beginning to take over a lot of your thinking, particularly your spare time thinking. And I think that was the case with me. So you start thinking, well, gee, what am I going to do? And, you start thinking assignment. And the interesting thing about that, and I think this is also in my memoirs, is that being an airlifter, you know, C-133s at Travis before I went to Vietnam, I pretty much knew I was going to go back to airlift. And my assignment came down probably about December there. I think I had a couple of months to work with it. That said, I was going to go to C-141s at Norton Air Force Base, which was in San Bernardino, Southern California. And, of course, that was a real plum assignment because the 141 was new in the inventory. It was a jet it was the first jet, real jet transport airplane. It was going to be a great thing to fly that thing as it was almost brand new in the inventory and sort of progress through my career with that airplane. So I was pleased at that, with one exception. Problem was that I had, at some point, and again, I think it ties into this, I think I'm going to survive thing. At some point, I had started writing to I wouldn't even call her my girlfriend, a girl I knew back at Travis, who I dated occasionally, rarely, I would say, it was more accurate, and saw at, you know, clubs, bars in San Francisco and parties in the Bay Area and at Travis, and we sort of seemed to be compatible. And I had started writing her, and she wrote back, and we both, I think, thought there was something cooking there. And I knew very well that if I went to San Bernardino, that was going to be the end of that relationship. So in the back of my mind, I had this idea, which I didn't bother with while I was in Vietnam, that I needed probably to get my assignment changed and go back to Travis if we were going to explore this relationship. The long and the short of that story, I'm jumping way ahead now, is that when I finally did get back in February, I stopped in to see my old squadron commander, who's got an interesting piece of history associated with him in Vietnam, which I think I will mention because it's public record. But I went to see him, and I told him the story and asked him to get the assignment changed while I was on leave back in New York, which he did. And so I ultimately reported back to Travis rather than San Bernardino, and I ultimately married the girl, and she's still living with me here. So that worked out fine.
Yeah.
But that is kind of an interesting thing. But I know I haven't directly answered your question, Steve, but you do start to think... I think it's the opposite. It's not so much what you start to think about as what you weren't thinking about up to a certain point. At least in my mind, you sort of close everything out and you just say, "This is it. I don't want to talk to anybody. I don't want to know too much about what's going on anywhere else. I'm just doing this. And if it's over and I survive, then I'll get back to the normal world." And that again is that. You know, we used to call, you know, the States the real world, and, you know, there were phrases that we used that I think unconsciously suggested that that's how we thought about things.
Yes, sir. And
I don't think I was any different in that regard. And again, just to reiterate, sort of as time ticks by and you become more and more aware of the fact that you probably are going to leave this place and go somewhere else, you start coming out of that cocoon kind of a situation, and starting to think about the broader world and reality again.
Mm-hmm.
So I that's probably not as well as I could do if I sat down and thought about it for 2 weeks before I said anything, but that sort of was the feeling that I had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Okay.
So
now, you mentioned that the commander, squadron commander,
his name was Jerry Curley, Kehrli. And he was a hell of a nice guy. He was a damn good commander, but he made a big mistake, and people my age remember it because it was very public. He was a commander in Vietnam of one of the units there, I think at Tonsonu Aerial Port Squadron, if I'm not mistaken, although I could easily be a full colonel. And he got caught smoking marijuana, which, of course, today is a joke. People say, "So what?" But back then, a commander in Vietnam in the 60s, it was a major, major deal.
Uh-huh.
And he wound up getting convicted and winding up in Leavenworth over it, believe
goodness.
It or not. Yeah, it's, 5 years, I think, court-martial, the whole McGilla. Yeah, honest to God, sorry for you. I know guys your age to believe something like that, but it's absolutely true.
Wow.
Jerry Curley was his name. Good guy. And he got out afterwards, and I don't think they... hammered him too bad in terms of retirement and all of that sort of thing. He might have lost one grade or gone back to lieutenant colonel for retirement purposes or some such thing. But sad story in a way, because he was really a good guy.
Very sad.
But he made a mistake, he wasn't drinking. He was smoking a joint every once in a while at night, but it was illegal. You could get plastered every night at the bar, but you couldn't smoke a joint. That's just the way the rules were.
Yeah.
And he broke them. So it's
how was he as a commander?
Oh, a super guy. Terrific. He was, the 84th Squadron Commander at Travis there for years. He's a wonderful guy. Yeah, great.
Competent?
Oh, yeah. Completely competent, personable, everything. I mean, he was a good commander.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What a shame.
Yeah, it was kind of sad. Yeah.
Okay.
But again, I'm not telling any tales out of school. That's a public record.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Now, when you arrived in the United States, what was that like, getting off that freedom bird?
I think, actually, I'm going to have to back you up to answer the question correctly. I think it started sooner than that. It started when the airplane lifted off from Saigon. It was like day and night. Like the whole thing almost disappeared from your mind, at least temporarily. It's over. I mean, that whole thing is over. I'm out of here. I escaped. I survived. I made it, And it was almost instantaneous when the gear came up on the airplane, and I you could feel it in the airplane. It was not just me; it was everybody. You really at that point realized, I made it. I'm going home, and then you start to think almost as if it didn't happen, at least for a short while. and in my case, probably for quite a while. It was like, okay, that's done. The guys I knew back there, they're going to continue their job. I probably never see them again, although that turned out to be unfortunately not correct. You know, at the reunion, I saw several, of course. But it was just an instantaneous, sharp break, like somebody hit you upside the head with something and snapped you back to a reality. I mean, almost that sharp, I think, in my case. Funny thing, I remember Phil Teague, who I think you met Phil at the reunion, if you don't remember. He was kind of a boisterous isn't quite the right word, had an aura about him almost, of a really outgoing guy. He was walking with a cane, a little hunched over, not old, but I think he'd been in an accident. Phil Teague. Phil and I were sat next to each other on the airplane coming home. And the funny thing I do remember is Phil had this enormous bottle of Lavoris, you know, green mouthwash with him. And we drank the thing all the way home. Of course, it wasn't Lavoris. it was cream de menthe, believe it or not, an enormous bottle of the stuff. And we just quietly sipped on that all the way back to the States. And, of course, the stewardess knew what was going on. I think it was a Continental flight, if I remember. She knew what the heck was going on, but we were behaving ourselves, and they didn't care. You know, kind of funny. But again, that does really, in a way, tie to your question. It was like, okay, it's over. Let's have a drink. Well, by the time we get home, we won't even remember it happened, you know? And I think when I got off the airplane, to answer your question directly, I think it was at San Francisco. I think it didn't land at Travis. It landed at the International Airport, San Francisco. And I don't even think I spent the night. I think I caught a flight. I honestly don't remember. May have spent one night. If I spent a night, it was in the Jack Tar Hotel. That's a vague memory. Or else I just caught another airplane and went straight to New York. I honestly don't remember. No, that's not true, because I went down to Travis to see Curly before I went home.
Okay.
So I honestly don't remember. I don't remember how it all evolved.
What month and year is this now?
This would have been February 67.
February 67.
Yeah.
Any kind of anti-war protesting going on?
None that I saw. And again, you've asked that question before, and I guess to answer it again, we were vaguely aware through the Stars and Stripes and other radio programs that there was a protest in progress. Don't think we realized how intense it was. Don't think we cared much.
Well, I meant at the airport.
At the airport, nothing that I recall.
Okay. Did you ever have any run-ins with anti-war protesters?
No. I subsequently came to know a few people socially who were very anti-war.
Mm-hmm.
We had, you know, conversations. They had their opinion. I had mine. They never got angry or anything, as best I recall. The society that I lived in was not the, you know, I was past the college thing and I was past the hippie thing. So that group of people was probably a subculture in a literal sense to me, in that they were younger, poorer, less worldly wise, perhaps didn't really know what they were talking about, was probably my bottom line opinion.
Okay.
You know, if they knew what was really going on, they'd understand better.
Yeah.
But they didn't, because they were just kids. You know, that was probably my thinking. And, you know, just leave them alone and, you know, they'll go away or, you know, whatever. I think the only one that sticks in my mind in a different way would have been, what year would it have been? The 68. Was it the 68 Democratic National Convention in Chicago where they had the riots and all of that sort of thing? I think that's correct.
I believe so.
Yeah, and of course that was nationally televised and very intense. The politics within the Democratic Party with McGovern, who is considered a real peacenik, for lack of a better word, was making a run for the presidential nomination, and there were a lot of people of that persuasion who had a lot of influence, were getting a lot of television time. I remember there was a Catholic priest, Garrigan, some such name, who was very politically active and very anti-war. And there were, Jane Fonda's ex-husband, who's now a congressman, I think, from California, who was very young, very active anti-war protester at the time. I want to say Bruton or Brutom. That's not it, but it's something like that. But, you know, again, it's easy to remember or find out who I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
he's still out there, and of course, you know, times have changed for him too. But although I think he's still a very liberal Democrat, but so, but in any case, that whole '68 convention brouhaha was, you know, brought the thing home in a different way. It was all, sort of like, holy smokes, this is serious. You know, this thing is really becoming a national problem here, rather than just a bunch of, you know, flower children, you know, romping around in a park in San Francisco somewhere. So that I do recall as maybe an awakening of things to come, which of course did come later through the, primarily the Johnson administration, because he, I guess he won that election and became the president. No, wait a minute.
That would have been 64.
No, that's not possible. Johnson became president when Kennedy was shot and then had a second term. So this may have been in an attempt. I don't know. Who won that election?
In 68, that would be Nixon.
Actually, Nixon beat the Democrat. That's exactly right. And Nixon then was almost in the process, I think, from that day on. I think he made a half-hearted attempt to take a look at the war and see if it was winnable, realized it wasn't under the political circumstances, and probably from early in his administration, the philosophy of the U.S. government, although it may have been a secret philosophy, was let's get the hell out of here as quick as we can. And, you know, took years and years for it to happen, but I think at that point, probably that Chicago convention was where the thing went over the hump. Everybody said, oh, and of course, TED had happened in January of 68, TED offensive. So combination of those things, I think you could probably call that the point where we went from seriously thinking we could win to seriously thinking we ought never have started as a nation, you know.
Well, just out of curiosity, when you got back in 1967, and then you found yourself back at Travis. I assume you were back, what were you flying, C-130s?
133 again,
133. Okay. What did you hear in terms of the progress of the war throughout the rest of 67, and especially leading up to Westmoreland coming back to the United States and giving his progress report that basically the war was almost at an end?
My recollection is very little. I think I was busier. See, two things happened. Well, several things happened. Now I'm dating this girl with some seriousness. I am now back with enough flying time in the 133 from my previous tour to where I'm sort of in a fast track to become aircraft commander, which is a biggie, you know, the pilot in command. And, of course, there's an awful lot of studying and training and whatnot involved in that, in addition to just flying the missions. We were flying very heavily into Vietnam. I was flying, pilots don't believe it today, or they believe it, but they find it hard to imagine. I was flying 130 hours a month or so regularly, which was over the maximum by a few hours, and usually wound up flying on a waiver because we were supporting Vietnam so heavily. You know, a combination of all of those things, I don't think I paid a lot of attention, to be honest with you. It was like I did my part, and it's, you know, the war is continuing. I think in the early days I probably still thought we were going to win in 68, probably, but by 70 I knew we weren't. But I didn't pay a lot of attention. One thing does pop into mind, though, that might be of interest. During those days, the black population in the military was becoming very agitated, very belligerent. Not, and obviously not every person, but particularly the young enlisted blacks were becoming very agitated as a group. There were people within the groups that were stirring them up. Anti-war, black power. You're talking about the period of time where black power was big, where the Afro haircut was big, and of course you couldn't wear an Afro in the military, and so there was agitation about that. The black Muslim thing was starting to occur, and that included a beard, and you couldn't have a beard, so there was a lot of agitation about that. There were Travis, in particular, there were some riots in the dormitories, which is historic. You know, you can go back and discover the details from newspapers and all that sort of thing. But there was some low-level, relatively low-level rioting in the barracks amongst the young blacks. That obviously got our attention. And I guess we sensed that it was somehow war-related, but not necessarily directly. It was more related to the burgeoning civil rights movement, which, of course, was in full steam by then. with a lot of, you know, Stokely Carmichael and Malcolm X were all figures, prominent figures of that particular period in time. So that's something that I do recall and do recall being very concerned about because of what it might portend for the future. You know, where the hell are we going? We're losing our integrity. You know, we're no longer one anymore Air Force. Now we're a black Air Force and a white Air Force, and that's not good. So that was a matter of real concern, I think, to just about everybody. And you know, if kinds of attitudes among the white guys of, hey, if you wanted to be in the military, you knew you needed a haircut. You know, what's this with the afro? And you can't wear your hat on top of an afro. You look like an idiot. And so, but there was on the black side this need to, when they got out of uniform and went down to San Francisco, identify culturally within their culture. So very bad situation in terms of trying to sort it out. It is a comical, to my mind, comical. Maybe not to everybody. There was a disease which appeared during those years that had never been anywhere before, the disease that struck black men only largely, which came, was epidemic at that time and has disappeared since. And I say that somewhat tongue-in-cheek because it was quite serious. It was called pseudofolliculitis barbae. And the disease basically was ingrown hair on the face as a result of Negro physiology and physiological characteristics, particularly curly hair. The theory was that because their hair was curly, it tended to curl and ingrow and infect. And I think there's probably some truth to that. If you think of, you know, maybe black men you've known, frequently they do seem to have like an acne problem around their beard area. But this thing became an epidemic in the Air Force, and of course the reason, at least a lot of us white guys thought the reason was because if they get the doctor to declare that they had this disease, then they could get a beard. Because you wouldn't have to shave because you'd let the beard grow out and this ingrowing would stop. Okay. So it's a little interesting point of history, this whole thing about this pseudofolliculitis barbae, which again, I mean, you got tons of black guys in the military today, and they seem not to be suffering from it anymore. So it was a thing. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting cultural thing. Unfortunately, of course, created division, and that's the bottom line. And that's why I say it's funny, but it isn't funny. It's got comic elements, but certainly wasn't funny in the long run.
Tragically.
Yeah. Exactly. But again, understandable in the context of 1968 and what was going on in the black community. Mm-hmm. So anyway, those are some things that do pop to mind, but direct confrontations with anti-war protesters, no. And see, another thing happened to me, Steve, which I think, no, you don't know from the biography because I didn't send you that part. I was only home 1 year. February 68, I got home. I'm sorry, 67, I got home. And February 68, I'm sitting here now trying to, I think I had just become an aircraft commander in the 133. I'm getting more serious with my girlfriend, and the Pueblo crisis kicks off in Korea. The North Korean special forces made a raid on the South Korean White House called the Blue House, but their White House in Seoul, an armed raid trying to assassinate President Park, which failed. But as a cover for that, then the North Korean government ripped off the Pueblo, which was a U.S. Navy intelligence ship, which had been sitting off the North Korean coast for endless years. But the next day they seized it, and this became an enormous international incident and almost precipitated the Third World War, although it's not all that well documented in history, but I think people who know will tell you how close we came. So we deployed an enormous force almost overnight in February of 68 now to Korea. And I know because of some of the things I did there how close we were to war. Again, so here now you're fighting in Vietnam, and you got this probably more serious potential war regenerating in Korea because of the nuclear equation. The Russians were still powerful then, the Chinese, of course. And I got deployed for that after being home a year to be a forward air controller in Korea should the war start.
Wow.
Yeah, so again, I was very busy, and I'm probably too busy to worry about politics at the time.
Yes.
excuse me.
Now, for the year from 67 to 68, that you flew support for, you said a lot of the missions you flew for that year were support for Vietnam.
Right back into Vietnam. Yeah. Right, so usually once a month.
You were flying back to Vietnam.
Oh yeah, once a month.
In Tonsonup, basically.
Frequently, the big airfields, obviously. Uh-huh. We weren't going to any little places anymore. Tonsonut, Da Nang, Quy Nhon, once, and that was dicey because that airfield was really too short for a 133. But I did manage to get it in there and get it out. I remember it's another not so funny thing, but I remember having to back the airplane, would back up because of the propellers, you could reverse it, and back the airplane right up to the fence at the very end of the runway for my departure, and then ran the engines right to max power with the brakes set, which isn't normal, but to get everything as powerful as possible before I let go of the brakes, and roared down the runway and just literally blew half a village of course, the village was made out of C-ration boxes, but blew the thing. I mean, it must have blown the thing to 300 yards from where it was sitting when I started.
Oh.
That's sad, but, these people that, they just... They're used to it. They picked up, and they probably picked up and put everything back together by evening. But I do remember blowing the place all over, and not intentionally. I didn't realize it was happening until, it was too late to stop.
Mm-hmm.
But so Quy Nhon once, Da Nang frequently, Tonsonut frequently, and probably Cameron Bay once or twice, delivering cargo or picking up. Actually, the primary mission we had for the 133 was helicopter rotation. We would typically fly either five or six Hueys or two Chinooks. I think it was two. I think we could carry two. Here's how it worked. Let me start at the beginning. A typical mission would be to go from Travis to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which was a big Army depot for helicopters, repair and preparation. We'd land at Harrisburg. We'd pick up new helicopters, either refurbished or brand new, go back to Travis and then head out to Vietnam and take them wherever, Tonsonut, Da Nang, or whatnot. And then we would pick up beat-up ones, shot-up ones, crashed ones, and bring them back to ultimately through Travis to Harrisburg again. And that was one of our primary missions in addition to installing the Minuteman missile during that same time frame. And it was because of the size and weight capacity of the airplane, of course. Typically, during a month, I would probably make one circuit from Travis to Vietnam and back, about 60 flying hours, one trip over to Harrisburg and back, maybe another 10, and a couple of short trips within the United States running missiles and that sort of thing. Sometimes they'd squeeze two Vietnam trips out of you in 1 month, and which meant you were gone for the whole month because they typically took 2 weeks to make the circuit. And that was generally what we did. Yeah.
Now, when you would land in Vietnam,
yeah,
how much time would you spend there, and what kind of information were you able to get?
Nothing. And again, because the time would be always short. You only crew rested there in an emergency, which is to say the airplane broke on the ground in Vietnam so badly that you couldn't stagger it out to the Philippines, which was the next stop, a couple-hour flight to Clark Air Base. So you were there for minimum ground time, trying for 2 hours total. And during that time, of course, you had to debrief your flight. You had to get something to eat if you could, get your weather briefing, file your flight plan, get an intelligence briefing, which normally just consisted of the essential information, departure, safety kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Take off, climb immediately, turn left, turn right, avoid this area, and that. Was it. I mean, you didn't get a lot of detail. And you were in and out before you knew it, basically.
Okay.
So,
any time when you were flying back into Vietnam that you were shot at?
Not that I know of, no.
Okay.
Probably was, but unless you got hit, which I don't think we ever did, you didn't know it. Yeah.
And when other pilots that flew in, were there ever any stories circulated that they were shot at or shot down?
Not often, if at all. The biggest concern actually was friendly artillery.
Oh.
Yeah, we were much more concerned with that because at the altitudes we flew, enemy ground fire in the south was essentially a non-factor until you were extremely close to an airfield, and we evolved procedures to defeat that. We evolved a very steep approach angle on final approach so that you could approach an airfield much higher than normal, mm-hmm. much closer in, and then make a very steep descent to the runway. I think 4.5 degree glide slope, which sounds very shallow, but for an airplane is actually about double normal. Normally you're on about a 2 degree slice coming in, mm-hmm. and we were on a 4, 4.5, as I recall. So that wasn't the problem. The problem was that while you were coming from the coast, let's say to Saigon, which might have been a 20-minute flight or so, and then maneuvering in the traffic pattern, we knew that there was a lot of artillery flying around, mm-hmm. and not ever really controlled in any sense. We always said if every artillery round that the friendlies were firing had a tracer on it, we probably would have never entered the country. But never had an incident where we got hit or anything. But mm-hmm. but we were, that was our concern. That and just traffic density. Mm-hmm. I going into Saigon would have myself, the co-pilot, and everybody in the airplane who wasn't doing something standing behind us, standing behind the two seats, looking out the windows.
Wow.
That was the biggest concern, was just running into something because the traffic density, particularly as you approach the big airports, you know, you got fighters, you got transports, you got little airplanes, big airplanes, helicopters. That was the thing we were concerned with, was a mid-air collision.
Mm-hmm.
Very definitely the big concern. So we had eyeballs all over the cockpit looking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did that ever happen to you,
Not not in the 133. No, I had a couple of close calls in the 01, mm-hmm. but
mean flying those operations. Other C-133 pilots or
again, nothing that I ever heard of where mm-hmm. there was an extremely close call. But okay. we were taking the precautions to avoid it. You know,
okay.
yeah.
And let's see. Any other types of support missions that you flew during that year? Just primarily bringing in and taking out helicopters?
The helicopters, and as I said, the airplane, the 133, was really designed to take the Minuteman missile from, I think I've told you this, from the factory mm-hmm. up at Hill Air Force, or near Hill Air Force Base in Ogden, Utah, where the Thiokol put the solid propellant in the missile at the factory. Of course, at that point, you had a very heavy object, you know, 100,000 pounds or so. That had to be delivered to the missile fields up in the northern tier in the northern states, and a lot of research had been done about doing it by truck and by train and in various ways, and ultimately they decided that the safest way was by air, mm-hmm. less likely to crack the solid propellant through repeated shocks that you might get on a highway or on a railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And so the airplane was basically designed and built to carry those 1,000, ultimately what amounted to, I think, 1,000-some-odd Minuteman missiles from the factory to the various sites. So we were always doing that in between doing other things. We always had a couple airplanes up running that route. You might put, depending on maintenance and things, weather. Winter was very bad. If you're trying to get to Malmstrom Air Force Base in Great Falls, Montana, in the middle of the winter, you might spend all week trying to make one run, you know. But over the course of many, many years, we put the whole 1,000 in.
Okay.
That one squadron did.
Yeah.
So that and some other space support. We'd occasionally go to Denver, pick up a component, take it down to Cape Canaveral, things like that.
Yeah.
We did not do a lot of ordinary cargo hauling during those days just because of the priority of the other things and our capacity to do them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, what did you think when you heard about Tet?
Tet.
68.
Remember? Yeah. I think I knew it was coming. Actually, I hesitate to say this because it really sounds overblown, but I'll say it because it's true. In my memoirs there, and I will, you know, the last battle thing that's in my memoirs there where I was, Colonel McCutcheon had said, no more combat for you, you're going home in a few days, and I was taking the airplane, ferrying it over to Benoit for maintenance. I presume you've read that. And I had the Vietnamese lieutenant in the back seat. Just joy, he was just along for a, not joyride exactly, but for an orientation and just trying to get a look at the terrain around Saigon. And we accidentally ran into a battle just to the north and west of the airfield. And we were able to coordinate the ground troops and other things to basically destroy the enemy attack, and quite a few kills on that one. Subsequently, somebody in the intelligence business told me that that attack was actually a probe, a test of an intended 1967 Tet Offensive. And that when it failed by virtue of that little accidental encounter between the Viet Cong and the airborne unit that was out there patrolling, that the Tet Offensive was actually put off for an entire year and didn't occur to 68. Now that sounds a little crazy to me, that one little confrontation could have actually had that effect, but I was told that. To answer your question, when the Tet of 68 came, I don't think I was too surprised. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And what did you think when you heard President Johnson decide not to run for election?
That's an interesting question. I do recall having a reaction. I think I just felt sorry for the guy. Mm. I knew the kind of circumstances, the pressure that he was under. Actually, when I was in Korea during the Pueblo, I was involved with something I can't even talk about even today. It was a reconnaissance mission, I can tell you that much. But I actually was the action officer for it as a captain, and I talked to Johnson every day, personally. He called.
Wow.
And he was, and this is not necessarily to his benefit, mm-hmm. but he would call on the old Donald Duck secure telephone that we had, and KY3, I think it was called. Your voice was distorted. I don't know if you've ever used one, but you sounded like Donald Duck a little bit on it when you were talking. And he would call every day, I think at about 3 in the afternoon, and he personally he didn't want any filters between him and the data. He wanted to talk to me personally because I had the information. So every day at 3 o'clock, I had to be by the Donald Duck phone booth there waiting for his call. And I thought it was kind of pathetic in a way, you know, that he would have to do that. It was good in a way that the guy was that interested and that involved and had that kind of energy, I suppose, to be able to deal to function that way. But I also thought it was kind of sad that he had to do it that way. And I think, you know, you could see on television, as things started to deteriorate, the physical toll that it took on him. I mean, the poor man looked horrible. And so when he decided not to run, I certainly wasn't surprised, and I just felt sorry for the poor guy, you know. Okay. That was my basic reaction.
Yeah. Now, when you were flying in Korea and during the Pueblo incident, how long did you stay there?
Oh, no, I was not flying. I gave you that impression. I'm sorry. But I went there as a forward air controller. That's a true statement.
Yeah.
But the sad story was that when we got there, we discovered there was no close air support system of any kind, mm-hmm. and there were no airplanes. The country had evolved since the Korean War into a almost completely air defense orientation. Mm-hmm. There was ADCC, Air Defense Coordination or Control, I don't know, Air Defense Control Center, mm-hmm. at Osan there, which is where I wound up, in the 314th Air Division headquarters. Again, pathetic. World War II technology. Grease board with guys drawing tracks on the backside of it with grease pencil. It looked like something out of 8th Air Force in England in 1945. But that was the state of the art there, and no close air support system whatsoever. So I and several other guys, this is in my memoirs, but not the portion I sent to you, guys who were sent, they sent 90 forward air controllers over there, and all we could do was get drunk. There was nothing to do in the dead of winter, February, Korea, it's cold. And some of us, after about 2 weeks, decided that was enough of that, and we went looking for work, literally, and I found a long story, but I found work in the headquarters, and basically I and some other guys who I knew drifted over to the headquarters and formed a little nucleus kind of sub-office under the guy who was DOCP, Director of Current Plans. But he sort of had a plans and operations job, full colonel, by the name of Alva T. Wilkerson. Very, very wonderful man. Very brilliant. Had just come from the Pentagon when the war started. I think he'd hardly gotten off the airplane when the whistle blew, and he walked into a disaster, you know, an area that had been neglected for 20 years, and all of a sudden he's got to fight a war from this office. But I worked for him for the whole duration of the 6 months I was there. But what we did was we tried to create a close air support system, and we did a lot, writing documents, concepts, philosophies, structures, regional geographic structures, equipment requirements, communications networks, started the ball rolling to getting some airplanes, which after I left showed up from Vietnam, as I understand. The O-1s, as they were replaced by O-2s in Vietnam, were moved up to Korea to create this close air support system, which didn't exist. Okay. So that was kind of an interesting phase in my life, too. But how did we get on that? You asked me.
Well, I was just curious how long you spent there.
Oh, 6 months. It was a TDY. Yeah. It was a six-month TDY that was almost overnight.
Wow.
Just got a phone call one morning in February and said, come get your combat gear and stand by for a call to get on an airplane.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, what you mentioned earlier that there was obviously some reconnaissance going on.
Yes.
Is the U-2 still the primary platform for that? Especially in
I guess I could probably tell you that the platform was an F-4.
Okay,
F-4. Yeah, that's probably all I can tell you.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the U-2s were probably flying, but I think that was probably, the results of that were probably going straight back to Washington.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so after you got back from Korea.
Yeah.
Mid to late 67.
68.
Or 68, excuse me.
Yeah, now we're in August of 68, I think.
August 68, getting geared up for the election.
That's right. The election was just about to occur, wasn't
right.
it? So I must have just got home when all of that hubbub was really going on the news in Chicago.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but that's got to be close. Yeah. That's right. But again, I think I was back from Korea, back in the squadron, back trying to get, the rust off the edges in terms of my flying, and at that, I'll tell you, one, again, funny in a way, I use the word funny in a lot of different contexts, but at that point I decided, this relationship with my girlfriend has got to go one way or the other. We've either got to quit this foolishness that's been going on for years and years and years now, or we got to get married. So I think I proposed around Christmas. It wasn't a couple of months later, and we didn't have a long engagement because we knew where we were going. We were married in April of 69, so it wasn't too many months after Korea that I just, said, let's get on with this, or call it a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
So we did. It did have that effect. But again, so busy with other things, trying to reorganize my life here every time I turn around, that I don't think I was, I was obviously saddened by what I saw in Chicago, and I knew at that point that we were in trouble, but I guess in a sense not much I could do about it, and so I didn't worry about it too much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Actually, one more question about Korea. Was there a point during your 6 months there, that you realized that what was happening was not going to escalate into a significant war?
No. I think when I left, we were just as likely to go to war as the day I got there, if not more so.
Why is that?
We had built up a force, and, things have a certain momentum of their own.
Mm-hmm.
The Pueblo, if I'm not mistaken, was still in North Korean hands.
Mm-hmm.
The general atmosphere there was, the day we got there, the atmosphere was, we got to go like hell to take this sleepy hollow, backwater of the American military up to war footing as quickly as we can. And I think that atmosphere was just as intense the day I left there. Every day was like, okay, there's still a few more things we got to do, and it could happen tomorrow.
Wow.
We knew that a MiG could get from the nearest MiG airfield across the border to Osan with two 500-pound bombs and be back across the border, and I think the whole thing didn't take 5 minutes. I mean, we were close, it was still very intense when I left.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that politically, if you could talk to the right people or read the right books, you'd probably find that, the burden on Lyndon Johnson just must have been unbelievable. you know, with between Vietnam, the trying to do the Great Society, which was his real priority on a domestic level, mm-hmm. trying to make that happen, being completely frustrated, I think, or not being frustrated largely by having to focus on Vietnam and then Korea, and then having, in a sense, probably the people he thought were, quote, his own people, namely liberal Democrats, really turning against him. You can imagine what the effect on the guy must have been.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, and what about the nuclear threshold? Was that always an ever-present threat while you were in Korea?
Absolutely.
And after?
Okay. Yes. Yeah. That was still, you know, I mean, we were still serious Cold War, you know. And so, yeah, that was always very close to the front of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, and again, I can't talk about too much details there, but in Korea, we knew what they had. We assumed they knew what we had, and the impression was that the willingness to push the button was fairly high, at least on the Soviet side.
They hadn't bought into MAD?
I don't believe MAD. Let's see. That's a whole history book. You know, when at what time frame was which philosophy the one that was driving the train? And not having been a SAC guy, I just have peripheral understanding of how that all worked. But we didn't assume that they had bought into MAD. I think you can say that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. For a minute, I thought MAD. What the hell is he talking about? Mothers Against Drunk Driving. But I do remember what the other one meant. So, yeah. Yeah. Mutually assured.
Mutually assured destruction.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, I want to say that was McNamara.
Yes.
That tried to implement that.
Right,
and
yeah,
so
McNamara
was a
disaster.
Yeah, by the time you got to Korea,
yeah.
MAD would have been a tenant, I believe.
Yeah, I think it probably was. I think you're right, but I can't really confirm that just from my own memory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. The rest of 68 unfolds. What did you think of Nixon's secret plan to win the war, that is, Vietnamization?
I don't think I thought about that much. I was more inclined to think about McNamara's strategies and tactics.
Hmm.
Not so much the political overlay, which was the Vietnamization, but the McNamara's, you know, drawing lines and fences and controlling key areas. And I knew that was a hopeless idea.
Mm-hmm.
From having been there, you know, I mean, absolutely hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
And I think within the military community in general, by that time, we were beginning to express the view, either privately or publicly, that, you know, there's only one way to win this war.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to fight. The whole concept, actually, of, and this is a Moreaism that's probably worth going down in the books, is, you know, the whole concept of a limited war is a mistake. There is no such thing. If there's a war between me and my neighbor over, you know, our flower garden, in the context, it's a full-scale war. And if you think you can fight a limited war, the lesson of Vietnam is that you're mistaken and you will lose, because it's very simple. While we were fighting a limited war, by definition, the enemy was fighting World War III, by their definition, and that's why they won. Put it the other way, the only way we could have won was to have fought the war within the context of, you know, one or two countries as an all-out war. It's the only way to win. I think we who were there at the time knew that. The memory is probably fading as time goes by, and we'll probably make the same mistake again as people you know, traditionally do. They forget history after one generation or so and make the same old mistakes over again. But that is probably the one political thing, political-military thing, that I understood better than anything else by the time it was all over, is limited war doesn't work. So when we couldn't do certain things in the North and were afraid of what the Chinese might do and decided to, to pull out and let the Vietnamese do it, which was what Vietnamization was, and was really nothing more than, in retrospect, and if anybody had a real brain at the time could have seen it in real time, was nothing more than the beginnings of the surrender, the pullout. you knew it wasn't going to work. So certainly by that time we knew it was forget it. And I felt pretty sorry for guys who were still going over it about that time, because I knew they were going into a futile effort. At least when I went, I thought that we were going to win a war. And that certainly helps, sustain you. Mm-hmm. But the guys who were going over in 70, 71 and whatnot, I mean, they were just holding the fort until somebody could get out the back door, in my opinion.
What did you think of the Kent State incident?
Very sad, but I'll tell you, by that time I was mad enough to I didn't feel very sympathetic about the students. Mm-hmm. They were rioting. They knew what they were doing. Mistakes, kind of a house of cards in reverse kind of a thing, just a series of blunders on both sides that escalated into, a terrible thing. But but my attitude by then was, hey, if you want to riot on campus, you better understand that, and if you're going to taunt guys with weapons and throw things at them, you could get hurt. I mean, I see it on television. You see Palestinians throwing rocks at Israelis with guns. Well, Palestinians are not stupid people. I mean, certainly they know that at some point some of them might get shot. And that's the way that goes. And if you feel strongly enough about what you feel strongly enough about, fine. But don't come crying to me when you get shot. I think that was my bottom line. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I didn't have a lot of sympathy for the Kent State crowd. Mm-hmm. I still don't. They had a memorial there a couple of weeks ago, believe it or not, and they still haven't figured it out. Mm-hmm. They're still talking about the wonderful liberal principles they were upholding against the National Guard SS or whatever the hell.
Okay.
but that's always been a very liberal school anyway. So.
And what were your thoughts as the war wound down and finally in 1973 we've got the Paris Peace Accords.
Yeah.
After the Christmas bombing and then April of 1975 North Vietnam captures Saigon.
Yeah, well, I felt like we could have negotiated a better deal. Mm-hmm. Than we did.
Well, what did you think of the Paris Peace Accords?
It was obvious. We were just, we were surrendering. We were in such a hurry to get out of there, we'd have given them anything they wanted. By that time, it was just a, once you, let's see, I'm trying to find an analogy, but it's like, you've only got, the thing is deteriorating so rapidly that you've only got a very short amount of time to even make it appear like things are in control. So you've got to move very quickly to get out before all the obvious flaws are detected and the bubble bursts and it just becomes total chaos. So I think, it was obvious to me that at Paris we were just, okay, whatever you want, please, come on, can we get on with this? Can we get out of here, before somebody notices?
Okay.
But again, that was, I was aware of what was going on. I watched the TV, I read the newspaper, but I had another life at that point. By 70, we had three kids in a hurry. So,
wow.
We had one in January of 70. Mm-hmm. The next one was in January of 72, and the next one was in October of 73. So they weren't even 6 years apart, three of them. Now I have other things to occupy my time as well.
Absolutely.
So I think I felt like, look, I did my part. The thing, this isn't working. It's obvious, and it's too bad, but it's time to get on with it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what were your thoughts, feelings, when news broke that Saigon had fell in 1975?
I remember it again. It's a question of feelings. I think it was ugly, it was just so pathetic. It was sad. You'd have wished that in the end it could have been, it's a hell of a word, but it's the one that comes to mind, more dignified. Mm. Like it could have been done, like with a, you know, like Appomattox or something, you know, rather than this ugly scene of buildings burning and helicopters crashing and people running around frantic and all of that sort of thing. So that was certainly one thought. It was like rubbing it in, you know, like, did it really have to end this way? Okay, guys, we surrendered. Did you have to do it this way? The other feeling, of course, which was, you know, thoughts about Vietnamese that you'd known, and, geez, I wonder what's going to happen to them, you know. Did they get out? Did they get killed? You know, where are they? You know, how are they faring? You know, if anything from military guys, just like your housekeeper, you got to wonder, you know, somebody had worked for the Americans for years and years, once the politically, you know, the new political machine moved in from the north, what kind of treatment were they going to get? Because people were certainly going to know that they had worked for Americans and things like that, thoughts like that. Because there was a great tragedy, which, from an airlifter's point of view, maybe even, well, this is a terrible way to put it, but again, it sort of put the lid on the thing. It was just like the ultimate tragedy was when that C-5, are you familiar with this story?
No, sir.
Okay, there was they were evacuating the city out of Thanh Nhat, and they were evacuating Vietnamese of just loading them up. And there was a C-5 that took off out of Thanh Nhat with a load of civilians, maybe some military too, but Vietnamese, just sitting on the floor, hundreds of them. I mean, none of this seats and seat belts and all that sort of thing. And I don't remember the details, but somehow the back doors came open in flight, and literally, I mean, half the load of people went out the door. Yeah, it's something. That's sort of my recollection. It was just like, you know, after everything else, this, you know, kind of a feeling that I remember having. Again, a guy in your position could, I'm sure, find the newspaper reports and, you know, the official reports on the whole thing. But it was just like, not this too kind of a feeling, you know, ultimately. And I think at that point, I think we psychologically, many of us just turned our back on the thing and said, I don't even want to talk about it anymore. You know, I don't want to look at it. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to hear about it. Mm-hmm. It's just tragic beyond description, you know, for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah. Now, before that, had you talked much about your Vietnam experiences from the time you got back until the end of the
war? No, surprisingly not. Not even amongst military guys. I mean, flying transports across the Pacific, you know, you take off from Hawaii heading for Wake Island, and it's 8 hours of, you know, just blue sky and boredom. Mm-hmm. And we didn't talk about it even then.
Was there a reason?
No, it's just... It's not normally done. I think guys only want to talk about it to people who share the experience, or people like you who are rare, who actually show some genuine academic or other interest. But for example, I can tell you that when I first joined the 84th as a second lieutenant, brand new green bean trainee pilot, basically. I mean, not a trainee literally, because I was out of pilot training, but trainee in the transport. The huge numbers of the people in the squadron, the senior guys, were World War II veterans, the officers and the enlisted people. And they never talked about World War II. Not a word. You couldn't get a word out of them. And if you really pressed them, you'd get a three-sentence something or other, and then they'd drop it and go back to something else. Now, I think only amongst themselves. I think World War II bomber guys alone somewhere would have talked a blue streak, like the FAC reunion, you know. But you get out of that context, and it's it's not so much personal or private. There's got to be a better word, but it's kind of like you get the feeling there's only a few people would understand, and nobody else is worth talking to, you know. I guess that describes it pretty well, I think.
Did you also have a sense that, not so much that no one else is worth or worthy of talking about it, but also most people just don't care?
No, not to not care. Just would never understand, and it's not worth trying to explain it.
Okay.
You know, I think that's more accurate. Yeah, yeah. And I think the World War II guys, even talking to a guy like me, you know, a young officer, a pilot and all, but trying to explain what flying, you know, beat 17s over Germany was like, and living in England and and, you know, having your squadron decimated daily, it's just, you know, they can't explain it to me because I'm not going to understand it because I wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a fair assessment. And so they just never talked about it.
Okay. Well, after the war was over in terms of the fall of Saigon,
mm-hmm.
what did... how was the Vietnam War important to you personally in terms of your overall development, as a pilot, as a person?
Hmm. Yeah. Very good question. I can't answer it in the context you asked it because mm-hmm. It wasn't after the war was over. It was after my experience.
Experience.
Couple of things, I guess. I think, first of all, it was, you know, and again, I've said this, you have to be very careful who you say things like this to because it wasn't always the same for everybody. But for me, it was the adventure of a lifetime, to be perfectly honest. I was young. I was in perfect health. I was probably at the peak of my flying skills, or almost. I was doing something that I really got to be just unbelievably good at. I got to do it with almost no interference from anybody. It was just on your own for a year doing your own thing. So in that sense, it was great in a way. I mean, again, you got to be careful how you use these terms. But mm-hmm. for me, it was. It was just exciting. I was doing exactly what I wanted to do, doing it well, having a good time doing it, to tell you the truth. I think in terms of flying, it certainly not so much matures you because it was such simple flying, but it did give you a lot of confidence in yourself that you could do probably more than you would have otherwise thought you could do
mm-hmm.
because you'd done so many things, many of them stupid, and survived them and learned from them that I think I really felt like I was a hell of a lot better pilot. I mean, you know, 10 years better pilot after 1 year in Vietnam
mm-hmm.
Just from the experience. I certainly learned, despite the old adage that the war is too serious a business to be left to soldiers, it's certainly too serious a business to be left to politicians, solely. The answer has got to be, in my opinion, that politicians obviously have to make the decisions, but they need to listen to military people a lot more than they did in Vietnam. That hasn't changed either, and probably never will. I mean, you can see that today, with Clinton administration and now Bush trying to take over and fix some things, and even in the case of Bush, not fixing things that people necessarily thought he was going to fix, or at least in the way that they thought he was going to fix them. And frankly, I think he's right. But there's an awful lot of pork in the defense budget. Think times change, threats change, and we're still building a military based on still in a lot of ways still a World War II kind of a scenario, and really based on whose district the factory is in more than, you know, what the real military requirements are. But I definitely learned, I guess, in a sense, mistrust is too strong a word, but the mistrust, I mean, I've got a master's degree in political science, too, so, you know, I tend to think politically, maybe more than most people do, but I won't say I mistrust politicians, but I certainly, they weren't George Washington anymore, I'll put it that way. They were human beings who made a lot of mistakes, and that was something I learned from Vietnam, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned...
The biggest effect
okay.
is I don't think I ever have since really trusted my non-military fellow American anymore because of what the protesters did and what they were allowed to do by the rank and file, and it continues to this day, you know, with the Clintons, and again, I obviously have opinions there, but, you know, the American people just don't care about their country anymore enough to get excited about anything if it doesn't affect whether they're going to get home in time for the ball game tonight. And I think that was very clear with the entire Clinton administration. And I think it began probably in Vietnam. So my opinion of the average American is extremely low. Mm-hmm. And I think it began back then. I think they're lazy, they are uneducated, and uncaring about almost anything unless it puts $20 in their pocket. And that's obviously a gross generalization, but I think probably the Vietnam experience taught me that more than anything else, sadly, yeah. But it's true.
What you mentioned earlier, that you didn't, in terms of your concerns or your comments about limited war, and then some of the stuff that you've said recently in terms of politicians' involvement and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious what you think about some of the recent deployments.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, they're limited in the context of limited war.
Yeah, they're not even limited war. I mean, what I honestly believe is in most cases the recent deployments were smokescreens to get Clinton out of trouble. But soldiers are not trained to hand out box lunches to little kids. As nice a photograph as that makes on the evening news, handing out candy bars and box lunches in Kosovo is not what militaries are constructed for. Mm-hmm. And I think we make enormous mistakes when we do things like that, mm-hmm. Because, among other things, because of what it does to the soldier himself in terms of how he perceives his real mission, and in peacetime, what it does to the family of the soldier, and ultimately to the military structure. I mean, our military is in disastrous shape.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, you can't retain the right people, and it's not money. And if George Bush thinks that by raising their pay he's going to solve the problem, he's as stupid as the rest of them. I hope he's smarter. I hope somebody is whispering in his ear, although it should be obvious to anybody who reads a newspaper. The problem with the military is not money. Yeah, give me a few extra bucks, I won't turn it down. But that's not the problem. The problem is trust in the leadership. And which isn't there. When Clinton says, I want that guy fired because he made that phone call, and that came up in the newspaper, and the general says, yes, sir, instead of saying, I resign, you got a problem. And we have that problem right now. And the other problem is going all the wrong places and sitting on your ass, to be blunt, doing nothing for endless periods of time. Guys say, no, it's not what I signed up for, and they leave. And sadly, what's even worse is that the ones who stay are the ones, in a gross sense, that just perpetuate the problem. So you wind up with a descending spiral of leadership and morale and everything else, and that's where we are today. It's just too coincidental that every time, Clinton got some bad press, some bombs fell somewhere. In Somalia at the pharmaceutical factory, and at Bin Laden's camp in Afghanistan, and Kosovo, and a half a dozen other places. You got to be real stupid to buy that story. But the American people bought it lock, stock, and barrel. Obviously, again, that's sadly the biggest result I think of those years is this cynicism on my part,
mm-hmm.
about an awful lot of things. Whereas I think in 1960, when I, bright and shiny graduate, I probably, I came from a 50s World War II, post-World War II, we're on top of the world mentality, and there really is an Easter Bunny. And I come to find out that if he ever lived, he's dead. but that's, I guess that's, life too, you learn.
Now, but in addition to what you've already discussed, are there any lessons other lessons that we as a nation should take away from the war experience?
Well, nothing that hasn't been said a million times before. I don't think. I think it's pretty obvious. You don't when you go to war and involve a nation in a war. First of all, you've got to one degree or another involve everybody. You can't give college deferments to kids with money and send all the poor black kids from Tennessee to go fight the war. You have got to build a consensus so that at least the vast majority of people in the country understand why you're in the war and believe that it's necessary. And then once you've done that, you got to go finish it quickly, because Americans are inherently impatient people, and get back to the business of America, which is business. Okay, those are simple lessons, but they've been written about a million times. I think they're true. We did, I think, generally follow that philosophy. For example, in the Gulf War, the consensus was built very quickly. Needs to be done. We did it with forces that were on board at the time. We won it handily, and we got the hell home. I mean, there's still people there, and that may or may not be a subset mistake, but in general, we did it the right way. That's the way Americans like to do business. Understand that there's a real purpose, get the tools on the table, finish the job, and let's go back and have a beer. So I think we need to learn those lessons, yeah.
Now, how long have you been involved with, and how has it been important for you in terms of your FAC association and the FAC regionals?
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's just very recent. I mean, I don't think I had heard of the FAC association much more than a month or two before the reunion.
This past year.
Yeah, okay. Right. So really my involvement was going to the reunion, and then subsequently, I volunteered to write a piece of that history book. And we're not sure where we're going right now. The thing, I hope I'm mistaken, but a lot of the enthusiasm seems to have waned since the reunion. It's either that or it's this reticence thing. We can't seem to generate guys to tell the story, for one reason or another. We chose consciously to wait for the first newsletter to come out, which is supposed to be in my mailbox today, coming out of Claude Newland and others up there in that Fort Walton area. And then once that hit the street, we were going to use it as a springboard to open the door to this, hey, we want to write a history book, guys, start sending us your, but ideally, if every FAC we contacted sat down and wrote the, 20-odd pages or so that I gave you and mailed it to me, me and other guys, we've got this thing pieced out by geographic region and time frame and things like that. But if they were to sit down and do that, and then we could compile it into a book, that would be the fruition of our effort. But some tentative efforts in that direction, you just don't even get responses. The guys don't want to bother, or they, I don't know what it is. You may know better than I. You probably have more experience with that than I do. You talked to a ton of people at the reunion, and it seemed like you were generating tremendous enthusiasm. But I don't know if it's sustained, or if I'm the only guy that's talking to you.
Well, I've talked to other facts. It's been mixed results.
Yeah.
Okay. How has this been important for you in terms of? You mentioned before that you haven't really had too much opportunity to talk about your experiences.
No.
Has the reunion helped you, and has becoming involved in this project helped you in any ways?
At least temporarily, it's regenerated an interest, and it caused me to see some things I had, photographs and whatnot, and organize them a little bit, and make some folders and whatnot, the interview here and that sort of thing, but not a. It's maybe just a consolidation kind of a thing, trying to get it all organized, but no going back and rethinking or anything of that sort. I think the memories are fairly clear in my mind. They're either clear or gone. I guess it's one or the other. Yeah.
Okay.
So I haven't gone back and tried to rethink it in any way. I'm too busy.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
No, let me think. No, not really. I think the only thing I would say to you, I do. We never really did tell me exactly what is the purpose of this thing. I mean, where does it go from here? What do you do with this
interview?
Yeah.
We'll transcribe it, send you a copy of it, and eventually, hopefully, we'll get it posted to the Internet, and it'll also become part of your ongoing project to write that fact book.
Okay.
That is the transcript and recordings, if you want them, are available to you for your project.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this. When you transcribe, do you make some effort, I hope you do, to clean up the English? I mean, you know, typical American, we talk in half sentences and change subject three times in one sentence.
Right.
Do you just go with a literal translation, or do you try and turn it into something somewhat literate?
Well, before I answer that question, if there's nothing else you want to talk about,
yeah.
I want to go ahead and end the interview.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, right.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Okay.
This will end the interview with Mr. Mike Moran.